everybody. Welcome back. Thank you very much for tuning in. You are listening to the Dom and Colin podcast. My name is Colin. I am not back today with Dom. He is off traveling the world, as it seems like he often is these days. But joining me, I am very excited to have on the show once again, Antonio Mazzaro. Antonio, how are you?
Colin, thank you for having me. Dom is an international man of mystery, so these are unusual shoes I'm stepping into. They're the kind of shoes that probably were handed to him by someone like Q. They've got some gadgets in them, so these are interesting shoes I'm stepping into.
I'm nervous now that you bring it up, that Dom may be an international assassin.
Yeah, who knows, right? Like, he was very cagey about where he goes and what he does. So I don't want to I don't want to impugn a criminal motive to our great friend Dom. But there are a lot of trips in the Dom Harvey planning this season, it seems like. So maybe he is into some kind of espionage. Yeah, that would be great.
Yeah, not unsuspicious. That's how I'm going to put it. But Antonio, speaking of international assassins and all that goes along with that, you are, of course, these days podcasting about The Leftovers with Josh Wigler and also Better Call Saul with Rob Cesternino over on Post Show Recaps. Loving both of those. And what do you want to tell the people about that? Because I am a big advocate. Anyone who can get into either of those shows, those are two of my favorites on TV. These podcasts are fantastic. Where should people be going to find that?
PostShowRecaps.com is the best place to go for all of our podcasts about those shows. And thank you very much for letting me plug them right up top. They're obviously the two most popular shows on television, Colin. Everyone is watching them. Yeah. No, they're not like Walking Dead or Game of Thrones level popular, but they are beloved shows. Of course, Better Call Saul takes place in the Breaking Bad universe. This season, the third season of Better Call Saul, is really amping up into Breaking Bad territory. I think it's fantastic. And The Leftovers is wrapping its final season, season three, in 2 weeks. So we are really at a great point where if you've ever decided, I'm holding on The Leftovers, I'm not sure, it's a great time to start the binge so that you can catch up for the live finale. First five episodes are a little slow. Everything after that, fire.
Episode 5, I would say, not to dive too far into it, I really, really thought episode 5 was a big hooker, to put it in a weird terminology.
Hopefully you're using the Carney term. Yes, it is. Yeah. It is a big hooker. Yeah, that is true. There is some interesting stuff that happens in 5. Maybe it's only the first 4 that are truly, really drawing dead. But they're in, maybe drawing dead isn't the right term considering 5. But it really does pick up. If you're not liking it after a few episodes, give it till about the end of episode 6 and see how you feel after that would be my suggestion.
Yeah, and Antonio mentioned we're only a couple weeks out now from the big Leftovers finale. The last time you were on this podcast, Antonio, was the merge of Survivor Cambodia, and you talked me into, over the course of that podcast, giving the Leftovers a chance for the very first time. I stuck with it then and was able to catch up for the end of season 2 live, and now people would only have to do, 2 episodes a day to get caught up in time for the finale?
Something to that effect. And The Leftovers is a show where sometimes 2 episodes a day can really wear on you. I binged it and rewatched it before this season, and it was a little tough at times. It's a very emotional show. If you're not familiar with it, the general conceit of the show is that randomly, just for no reason, or seemingly no reason, 2% of the world's population just disappears one day. It is not seemingly a rapture-like event. There are people who maybe think that, but there are other people who don't. And it's really just about the leftovers, the people who are back in the world and feel like maybe they should have been taken, or they're having to deal or process with everything that happened. And it occurs on that small level and a larger level. It's a really fascinating show. But of course, Colin, it's made by the people who made Lost. So that's why there are a lot of people who are just out, I think, completely on the show. And I guess if you haven't been in on the show, you don't have anything really emotionally wrapped up in this finale. So now would be a great time to binge, and you wouldn't have been spending 3 years saying, well, what's next? Like, where are they going to take this? Like a lot of people who've been watching the show all along. So I think there's a lesser possibility we'll let you down if you haven't watched it and you're getting ready to start.
Yeah. Well, I am definitely very happy to let you plug that and the podcast at the top of the show, because anyone who is not in on both of those things, their lives could be a lot better as far as I'm concerned. And I also want to point out that Dom will be back soon. I just want to flag this up at the top. I'm not sure when exactly, but we will definitely be doing – I'm not sure how many people he has to assassinate in the meantime. Yeah. But we will be doing our usual full season in review podcast. Those take a long, long time. But today what we're going to be doing with Antonio is really just trying to hit on the major talking points of the finale and get some early takes out there and see how it goes.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to you and Dom's inevitable 3-plus-hour podcast on everything that was Survivor Game Changers, and I'm happy to be a midwife to that extent, to bring that into being. I'm happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I'm looking forward to that podcast just yet.
You know what? By the time it posts, Colin, it will be nice. We'll want it. It'll be like, oh yeah, nostalgia. I remember that season. It'll be good. I think. I'm crossing my fingers because, listen, we need something. We need something.
Yeah. Well, the good news for me at least is I can't sound any more insane than I have over the course of all of the podcasts leading up to this one.
Fair point. It's like this season was designed to put you on tilt. So this is good. I like where we're at in that regard for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely do. So, Antonio, let's dive in here. And I think the place we should definitely be starting is Sarah Lucina is our big winner of the season. I will say in pretty commanding fashion. Just how impressed by her game were you overall now that we've seen how it's all played out?
Listen, she played a great game. It is interesting that there were times in this game where her positions were very similar to where she was in Cagayan that had her ultimately get bounced, but she handled it a lot better this time. I think that a lot of times you think people return on these seasons and they overcorrect, right? They do something wrong. They can't change who they are. But in many respects, I feel like she made subtle corrections to her social game that improved it phenomenally. So well done by her. Well done by her. She definitely played the best game of anybody out there, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting that what did her in the first time was being the person in the middle and having it go wrong. And then this time it seemed like that's the only place she ever wanted to be.
Yeah, and it obviously went very right for her.
Yeah.
She moved around a lot on those votes. She was always on in the right spot. And that is a function of maybe not having someone like Cass out there who took not too kindly to what was happening in Cagayan. But it's also certainly a function of what everyone has said during and after the game here, which is that she built these great relationships that really did carry her. And there was some bitterness associated with that, but she was sitting in the final three with the right people, as she assured she was, so that that bitterness didn't ultimately cost her. And I think that that's yet again, credit to her for those moves.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally am with that. Now, at least on the Survivor Know-It-Alls, right after the finale aired, there was some talk of, hey, might Sarah be even like a top 10 winner or better than that of all time? Do you think she's in that kind of territory?
I think she could get to that zone. I don't think if she's in the top 10, she's definitely not in the upper, you know, echelons of that top 10. She'd be right near the bottom. But look, she won an all-star season by playing the game. And she won an all-star season by playing the game and not having the jury be bitter at her for that, which is not something we've seen always be the case on these all-star seasons. I think she played a very active game. And I think that that's certainly a point in her favor. I don't have a winner rankings list. I don't know, Colin. What about for you? Is she approaching the top 10 for you?
She would be approaching it. I would have a hard time putting her in the top 10 right now without at least giving it a little bit more thought. But I think you make a really good point. And the thing that impresses me the most about what she did is not only playing an all-star season in an active way and having people willing to vote for her at the end, she had people, you know, campaigning for her during
Champion,
the jury. Yeah, like actively excited to be voting for her, and not just Zeke and Andrea, but like Michaela was someone I thought might be a bitter juror for her. And she was in there really excited about the opportunity that she finally had, her life's dream of now getting to vote for Sarah to win $1 million.
Yeah, an opportunity she didn't realize until maybe like 30 days ago. But yeah, do you think there's anything to the fact that her two big champions in that regard were Zeke and Michaela, who are new school players from the returning season? They hadn't even seen their season of Survivor air on TV, and they're coming out here maybe not weighed down by any of that and able to say, I'm putting bitterness aside, you beat me and you wore my coat after, and you're a badass, and I'm going to give you credit for that. Michaela's saying, you took the advantage that was probably meant for me, and you flipped it on me and used it to vote me out. So these are new school players. I know Survivor has really invested a lot more in their casting in terms of recruiting these active players and people who want to play the game. So do you think this is a function on this season of having players like that be her champions?
I think that's a great point. I hadn't considered the angle of, because they haven't even seen their own first seasons play out, they're a little more fresh to this experience and not embittered, I guess, to put that kind of word on it towards the entire process yet. That angle, I think, is really interesting. But yes, I think it is definitely a function of this kind of new school attitude. And what I'd attributed it to is just casting a lot more fans and people familiar with the game, and then bringing those people back again, too.
And listen, I'm here for that. Like, I don't – there are drawbacks. Like, of course I would have preferred to see Ciri or Aubrey win this game. I personally would have preferred to see, from a human standpoint, just because I love the guy, Ty win the game. Not necessarily from a strategy standpoint, just from, like, where my heart is. But in terms of where my head is at and the things I like to see on TV, I don't have any problem with the player who played the most active game and who really did game the most, that we saw at least, being the one who is ultimately rewarded. And whether or not the new format changed the bitterness of the jury, which I'm sure we'll talk about, I do think that the having Zeke and Mikayla out there who weren't embittered, as you're saying, and who hadn't seen their seasons, didn't feel like weighed down by all of these things that they saw play out on TV, could just go out there with an open mind and enjoy the game and play the game and serve their roles as jurors. I think that worked really well in Sarah's favor as well.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know how many times I said over the course of this season on the podcast what I thought about all-star juries and how they vote for just the person who hurts their pride the least. I think this season has totally changed my mind on that, although I do think that was the case for a while. But let's get into it now, Antonio. Let's talk a little bit about this new Final Tribal Council format. And I'm particularly interested because you are a lawyer yourself, and hearing your takes on this from that perspective. Are you in on this new format?
I love it. We're not the first person, I'm sure, people to observe this. I've heard it mentioned on RHAP and in other places, but maybe the structure of the thing, maybe the outwit, outlast, outplay. Daniel Feinberg broke this down on The Hollywood Reporter as well. Maybe that can be modified or evolved when we see Survivor introduce things, even like an immunity idol. Sometimes that does take time to adjust. So they may adapt that part of the format because it did seem a little arbitrary. I like having breaks and sections, but generally speaking, I love that overall conversation with the jury, the town hall format. And Josh Wickler, our friend, wrote up an interview that he did with Jeff Probst and Mark Burnett, and he had this piece in The Hollywood Reporter, and Jeff basically said this is in part a function of the higher quality casting that they've been doing in terms of game players, that they can put all of these people out there in a circle and they can have an active conversation about the game that doesn't really need to be moderated by Jeff. Jeff doesn't need to be the one doing a ton of the guiding. It can be the players asking the questions. And again, so this is a benefit of the casting that they've been doing, and I'm greatly in favor of it. I love that it gives the players an opportunity to have a back and forth and not just have one question where a bitter person just stands up and shouts at them. I really am in favor of this. What about you?
Yeah, I definitely do like it as well. I'm also with you that I don't love forcing the outwit, outplay, outlast criteria onto people. I feel like what Jeff has always said up until this point is, hey, the jury gets to vote based on whatever criteria they want, and it's up to you, the players, to get them to give you their votes for whatever the reason happens to be. I think just in general, I would say I do not love the idea of Jeff playing such a major role in kind of shaping how this discussion goes. And hopefully it kind of reduces over time, because based on what I've heard, it sounds like this will be the new normal. And which I definitely am excited to hear. But yeah, overall, I love having these kind of free-flowing conversations with the jurors and letting them. I think it's crucial that if another juror brings up a point that they would like to ask a follow-up question on, that like a different juror wants to ask a follow-up question on, under the old format, they would not get another chance to speak.
Yeah, and that is that's a major, major deal for sure, because not only that, but I think it makes the jury feel like they have this more active and honored role, that they're not just coming in with a made up mind. I think that knowing that this is on offer, knowing that this is what's going to happen in this format, I'm hopeful that the idea is that they're going to be jurors coming there with more of an open mind as the seasons progress going forward. And I think we even maybe saw some open minds or some minds changed or cemented at this very final tribal. So I love this idea. I have a question for you, though. You're a guy who, I know you're Team Aubrey, but you have her scalp hanging on your wall from all the Michelle True thing. Do you think this was in direct response to what happened at that particular in that particular season?
Okay, that ties into the other thing that I was going to bring up about this, so I'm glad you asked this. I think it could definitely have an impact on why they chose to do this. The same thing we saw on Big Brother. This has become a thing on recent seasons. They have Dr. Will go in and talk to all the jurors about basically try to get them thinking in like the air quotes correct mindset to get like the most deserving winner. I wondered if, though, this would be a format they would not use if they knew it was going to be like a blowout, which I'm imagining they did during Millennials versus Gen X. I'm sure they were quite confident that Adam was going to win close to unanimously, at least. And this is not a very conducive format for that. So I'm wondering if they just decided to hold off on it for one season and then bring it in here. I think that is an excellent idea, though, that because of Aubrey, this could be something that like inspired them to make this change, whatever it is, though. I'm certainly happy that they made it.
It sounds like they knew it would work on this season because they were doing returning players and because they knew that the returning players might even be more bitter. We've seen that in the past, of course, and that they all want their moment in the sun. And so making the jury a really prevalent part of the game, and especially the final tribal, making them be the ones that are guiding this, gives them the opportunity to say, okay, people who really wanted to have a role here, you now have a role. And so I think it's clear that it will work on seasons like that. For new player seasons, I think if they're confident in the casting, I think it can work. I don't know. This is something they decided before the season. So it wasn't like they thought it wouldn't be a blowout, so it was a good time to do it. I don't think they're going to call an audible mid-season. I think this is what was decided before the season.
Well, I mean,
right?
It seems like an easy thing to call an audible on. You could call that audible the morning of day 39.
Sure. It doesn't require – I mean, yeah, it doesn't really require a different set. It doesn't really require much. I liked how the jury was seated and positioned. I think that the camera really captured well a lot of the shots that included multiple people. It wasn't like you had to have somebody walk up to a podium and make a statement, then cut back to the people that were sitting somewhere rolling their eyes or whatever. It was a good way to capture a lot of what was happening in real time. So – the physical setup of the thing maybe was really well planned. But yeah, you're right. They could call it on the morning of. I just hope that if they're going with this, this is something where just thinking like future players of the show you probably need to know what the jury format is going to be going into the season, right? Like that's something that will influence how you play the game.
Well, does it make a huge difference to you whether the jurors are asking questions one at a time or whether it's a big group dynamic? How would that impact you if you're making decisions within the game?
I guess if you feel like you're going to have more of an open or like a more of a back and forth conversation with the jury rather than one person standing up, maybe asking a question that isn't even a question, just making a statement and not giving you the opportunity to talk with them, I think that that's much different. I think you can put people on the jury if you're sending people there who you feel like, okay, well, if I can talk to them, because that's a thing, right? Like once you send somebody out of the game, you don't get to talk to them. They are in a position where they're in Ponderosa and people are talking to them and people are saying other bitter people are speaking things in their ear. I think as a player, I'm sure players would find it much better to know that this was coming rather than not. And I think that knowing that you always have the opportunity to talk your way out, it's got to be better than knowing that it's going to be happening without you and without your voice. And you're going to send someone into the void and they're going to emerge from that void, like with an opinion that you didn't really have a say in once you sent them out. I think as a player, this is probably a much better format. And I think that it does influence how you're going to play the game throughout. Like, okay, well, I'll seed that out or I'll work that out at Final Tribal versus I'm never going to have an opportunity at Final Tribal because they're just going to stand up and yell at me and their mind's already going to be made up.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely hope for the best with this twist. I just still wonder if it's even considered a twist, like this change in format. I still wonder just how often people are really going to be changing their votes at Final Tribal Council, and maybe it is under these circumstances more often than they otherwise would. My concern is just, it seems to me, and this is something Sophie brought up herself on Know It Alls, is if they were to be changing their votes over the course of Final Tribal Council, it really feels to me like it would almost always be as a response to what Jeff is trying to lead them to.
And that's possible. That's certainly a big concern and a big drawback is that you would have that. But I'm sure that Jeff is mindful of that. And I do think that would be a concern that were it very evident or clear ever on the show or after the show with what people were saying, that's the kind of backlash Survivor doesn't need or want, especially this late in the game. You don't want people talking about and tarnishing previous seasons by saying like, oh, well, heavily influenced by production winner. Like you do not want that. So I think Survivor is cognizant of that. I think Jeff is cognizant of that. And I think that you can make a mistake and do that on accident, but I think that he's probably not desirous of creating a change which will enable people to have ammunition to fire at him that says that. So I definitely get that concern. my hope is that when you talk about the Dr. Will thing, which, by the way, that sounds like we should call that something like priming the pump. That's a phrase I just made up.
Got a nice ring to it, Antonio.
Yeah. Having just made up that phrase, I think that we can. I like the idea that you're basically communicating to the jury like, yeah, you can talk about the game in Ponderosa, but you're going to enter this situation where we want you to have an active conversation and have an active role. You're basically telling the jury in advance, rather than you getting up and just making a statement or asking one question to somebody, you're going to have an opportunity to have a conversation. We want you to have a conversation. That's the role that you're meant to have as a juror. And I just think if you change the way people are framing this whole scenario as a juror, you're going to be more likely to get better results. Jeff also loves live tribals, Colin. Mm-hmm. So I think the idea that there could be life in final tribal is something that was the reason for this change. If you read that piece that Josh wrote with Jeff, and Jeff says, actually, like, I got to the end where I was like, this is boring. It's inevitable. Like, I know what's happening and I shouldn't feel that way. You said he felt that way for several seasons. So I like this. I like this change. I think it's with the right ideas in mind. I think your concern is valid, and I hope that they're cognizant of it and steer away from that as much as possible.
Yeah, I mean, I really want to be clear. I definitely like the change overall, although I do just have concerns about Jeff. And also, I feel like this was a very, very good cast for this kind of thing, not only because they're returnees who are more familiar with the camera and with the game, although I guess that is like the primary reason. It just seems like these types of personalities in people like Zeke, I think he likes stepping up. It's almost like Zeke was like counsel for Sarah here. I guess actually, Antonio, as a lawyer, how do you feel like there could be any other kind of changes made to Final Tribal Council like this?
Well, I've often thought it's interesting that the three-dimensional chess part of the game that a lot of people have talked about is you have to know who you're putting on the jury, not just because they'll vote for you, but because they will be in Ponderosa stating your case, arguing with the people who are hurt by you, advocating for you or not, those people. And Stephen and Rob on the Know-It-Alls got into a long discussion earlier this season about sending Debbie out and about how Stephen was basically saying, Debbie's the one you want mad at you because nobody lends any credence to what Debbie is saying. So if she's up there ranting about you, it's much less effective than if you put someone on the jury who is influential and whose opinions that are negative about you will be able to sway votes in a bad direction. So I think that that's a fascinating part of the jury selection portion of Final Tribal, if you'll call it that, mm-hmm. is fascinating. And Brad, in his post-game interview, said he's a lawyer. He's saying like his biggest misread, his biggest problem was putting Zeke on that jury in the way that they did, because he thought that he took Sarah to the end ultimately because he thought that Zeke would be bitter at Sarah. He thought, you know what? Like he was upset when he got voted out. He was like, you're wearing my jacket. You burned me. You blindsided me. But Brad didn't realize who Zeke was in terms of the game and how Zeke would have viewed that, which was power move. Good job. And Brad then choosing to take Sarah to the end was a misread of the jury as he knew it, and that's why he misread it in the way that he did. So that is a huge part of the game already. It influences the decisions you make at 5, at 4, in terms of who you're putting on that jury and when and how. So I think that that's a very fascinating part of the game that I don't think a lot of people consider really. And I think it's very difficult to consider. It's like handicapping a horse race, right? Like it's one factor in what you're doing. It may not be the only factor. It may not be a determining one. But that's a factor that I think people are cognizant of, especially returning players. Who are you putting on the jury? When are you putting on them on there? And that didn't seem to hurt Sarah at all, but clearly it hurt Brad big time.
Yeah. I know Cochran wrote his a paper, at least, his award-winning essay at Harvard right. about the idea of what the legal system could potentially take from Survivor and how they could implement that towards their jury system. Do you feel like there is anything that Survivor is doing right that the American legal system is doing wrong in this context, not to go down a million other rabbit holes?
Well, it's fascinating, right? Because in the jury selection mode of a trial, you do get some strikes. You get to basically say, without making any kind of argument as to why, I get to just strike a few jurors each. And both sides get to do that. You can also move that the judge will strike a juror for a reason that you don't have to burn that. So like if there's a juror who very clearly has a demonstrated bias to your side of the case and has said that during the proceedings, the voir dire proceedings, where you're selecting the jury and questioning them as a lawyer, you can just say to the judge, like, we'll get rid of that person. And ultimately, that doesn't cost you as one of your like preemptive strikes. You're just ones that you can make without any real explanation as to why. I think Survivor is a lot more difficult because the pool is already narrowed down for you. Casting does that. They bring the people in that you're going to have to put on the jury. And I think that the fascinating thing about that is you see a lot of people probably eliminated from consideration early on with personality problems, or they're the people that are rubbing people the wrongest in certain respects, and they don't let them anywhere near the jury. I think it would be fascinating to see a jury made up of all the personalities that you don't want. And the legal system itself, you have an opportunity. You have this bigger pool, but you don't nearly know as much as you do about the people that you're putting on a jury. And it's always a huge, huge risk. And you can have them fill out questionnaires, you know, demographic information about them. You do get a Q&A period. But obviously, Colin, I know you're a big fan of legal shows. You pay top dollar for jury experts to do background and analyze and do all these things. That is something that happens in huge trials. So this is not an exact science. And there are people that really make their livings reading people like that. And it's a difficult thing for a lot of lawyers. And certainly that can sway a trial huge when a person is clearly guilty, but you're able to convince a jury for various reasons in one way or another. So that is a broken part of the legal system in many respects. I don't know how to fix it, though, man. How do you have a jury of your peers when you don't have the right demographics out there? Survivor doesn't promise a jury of your peers. Your peers are everybody that played the game with you. So that's a much better scenario for sure.
Yeah, well, here is one lawyer who had a hard time with this system. It's Brad Culpepper ends up turning into our compelling losing finalist, formerly compelling, I would say. He got thrown to the lions, to put it in Leftovers terminology, Antonio, over the course of this finale. I mean, it wasn't even like 10 minutes in before I felt like he had basically no chance.
Yeah, and it's tough because he says when he heard Zeke say that champion thing, it really put him on tilt, and he was in a position where he wasn't really operating at his best because he knew, like, well, we made a huge mistake.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he got three votes, Colin. He got three votes, and I feel like Tribal was alive to the point where he maybe could have gotten to the point where he got five. I feel like Andrea's vote seemed to be a little more up in the air. I think Haley's vote was a little more up in the air. I do think that ultimately it wasn't his final performance or people on the jury one way or the other. I think Brad treated Ty in a way that wasn't consistent with who Brad is. And I think that really seemed, at least the way it was edited and presented to us, like it made a big difference. Was that your read that Brad's treatment of Ty really burned his opportunity to win overall in this finale?
That's a good question. Because for the first, I would say, like 36 days of the show, or at least for the first, certainly pre-merge, and I would say long after that, we saw a really glowing kind of side of Brad, I would say, where we're hearing about all that he was thinking, and we were getting like flashbacks to make it clear that, oh no, Brad was justified in saying what he said about Debbie. You shouldn't dislike Brad at all for this. But then, yeah, it was particularly this scene with Ty where it seems like this may have just been, you know, the Brad Culpepper that we donated to charity in our auction draft long ago, and it was just the edit. And that's actually just a question that I had for you is I don't know if Brad snapped, like if Brad thought, hey, I have this game locked up now. It looks like I'm going to be in the final three and Ty's just going to have to do what I say if he wants to be there too, at which point I'm just going to beat him. I wonder if there was more of this side of Brad out there that just didn't make the show. I would probably be leaning that way.
Yeah, that's possible. I'll say in the exit interviews that I've heard or read, Aubrey and Ty went out of their way to say that Brad was a great guy and that they really both had great things to say about him, and that they felt that particular incident was out of character for what they saw out of Brad in this turnaround in the season. And Debbie, who was the person we saw actually a bigger blow up with Brad earlier in the season, does end up voting for him. Now, I don't know if that says more about Debbie than it does about Brad. But she does vote for him, and she praises his testosterone, and who knows what other craziness is going on there. But in defense of Brad, I mean, when Jeff puts him on blast about this a little bit at that reunion show, without even getting into any other specifics, he gets up and says, I want everybody to know, like, I feel awful about what happened with Ty. I love this guy. That's not how this is. I don't think it was him getting cocky about the game. I think it was him at his worst, hungry, tired, really worn down and beaten down from having been on the bottom, having to win his way through in terms of all this. He chose the wrong negotiating strategy with Ty, and it cost him. And I think that's unfortunate because Ty was in his alliance before. Like, they were voting together. The idol play that got Malcolm out of the game was Brad and Ty working together in that realm. So I actually think that Brad could have had a better chance to get Ty back. Ty goes to Brad saying, I want to play with you. And Brad is saying, don't tell Sarah. And Ty is saying, fine. So I think that Brad just blew it with Ty. And I think that actually did probably cost him the game in many respects.
Maybe it was bad that he had the immunity necklace there. Maybe he just lost his tact because he felt like he couldn't leave.
You know what? That's a great observation. That's entirely possible. I think that for the people who were part of that, I think that was an influencing part in their vote. I think that if you're saying there was, you take everything out of the equation. Brad played with Ty all along until the last few votes. And so I think that there's a great opportunity for Brad to bring Ty in as a fourth vote. Then Brad's got to do what? Then Brad's got to ultimately get one more vote. I think it's entirely possible Brad could have also gotten Haley's vote or Andrea's vote. Maybe he was drawing dead against them the entire time. Maybe Sarah's final tribal, which was very good, would have been enough to sway the two of them. But I think that there wasn't really any momentum, and I think Brad burned himself on a couple of the votes he really, really needed in order to take himself across the finish line. And I think it was tough. I think it was, like you said, the version of Brad Culpepper that all season long you guys were like, man, we let Charity get this, that's the version that did come out in the final episode, really only, and it did seem like that was a huge part in costing him at least one vote, if not more.
Yeah, well, to return to the question of like that final episode and what and that kind of meltdown that he had, I would call it, with Ty, to me, to answer the question of like, was that just the edit making him look good before this and then looking bad afterwards? And I guess I did misstate what I meant, because I did, like you, want to definitely point out, right at the reunion, the first thing Jeff asks him, he just ignores and says, regardless of whatever that question was, basically, I want to get up and apologize to Ty. I feel horrible about this. I totally buy that this incident with Ty was not at all generally in line with how Brad would treat someone normally, both in Survivor and in life. But I do also think that the Brad Culpepper we saw pre-merge is not necessarily true to form either. I think it was a pretty glowing version of that.
Yeah. Well, so my question is, I love you guys' podcast. I listen all the time, and I listen because you talk about the show from this perspective. And my question is, so what do you think the reason for that is? Because he was going to be a finalist who got a few votes, so they made him look better pre-merge. Like, what is the reason for giving Brad the antiquing and the trees having balls and all the fun and nice and charming Brad Culpepper? What was the reason for the rosiness? Was it just to throw us off with this final vote?
I would imagine something like that. Yeah, I feel like we are, as I've said many times, like in the era of one of the losing finalists who like is in there with a potential chance, or in Ken's case, it's just total fabrication. We are in, I would say, the era of the compelling losing finalist, and I think Brad was just this season's version of that, and I am all for it. I think, like, when I think back on Game Changers, and I know that this has a lot more to do with just me, and probably most people listening will not remember this aspect of it at all, but for me, this was the season that by far, by 5 or 6 episodes at least, had the longest amount of time where I thought more than one different kind of person could win. Yeah, go ahead, sorry.
No, that makes a lot of sense to me. I think, and I heard that from you throughout the course of the season, and we talked about it. Like, that did seem to be the season was alive, and I certainly appreciate that as well. I just wonder, like, because the other thing I would say, the flip side of this is one of the number one criticisms I've heard from fans of this season is about the editing. Is about how, oh, that boot wasn't really well explained, or they really telegraphed which tribe was going to go to tribal council because we only saw strategy talk pre-challenge from one of the tribes. I do feel like we have big boots happening in like mixed episodes or not really having a ton of time paid to explaining how the game was played. So I feel like that has been a criticism of fans throughout the season. And yet I think it's impossible to say that the editing hasn't improved in terms of not telegraphing things with one clear person, because I agree with what you're saying. But again, I'm getting my thoughts and framing my thoughts about the edit from your podcast. So maybe we're in an echo chamber here.
Yeah, maybe. I think that's definitely been a concern that I've had, certainly with Ken last season. And then this season, I think I was just defiant against Dom. But yeah, I think that's interesting. I think that I am all about it. I think you're totally right that these last few seasons, I think, have had a lot better just episode-to-episode quality. And I think the idea of having, oh, it's obvious that this tribe must go to Tribal Council because they're the only ones we saw strategy from before the immunity challenge, like, that's no problem for me. That's fine. I'm glad that they're showing us as much as they can from that tribe. But the other concern of, hey, we have these boots going through that are just totally unclear, I think that is definitely a valid concern. In particular, I would think like the Michaela vote this season would stand out the most to me from with that angle in mind, although I do guess that may have had something to do with everyone getting up and talking. But there have definitely been plenty of votes that not only in this season, but in recent seasons where people have felt like there wasn't a great explanation. And I think that is a valid kind of beef, but for me, I'm totally okay with that on a personal level. As I've said, what I'm interested in is an unclear winner and just exciting eliminations that I didn't see coming. And I think the editing team is pretty thinking along the same lines. Like, it seems to me that hashtag blindside popping up at the end of the episode seems to be the goal from week to week, or more weeks than not every single week, and I'm okay with that.
Yeah, and listen, we're talking about a season where we had two boots that they didn't even really need to vote on with Jeff Varner and Suri, and for different reasons, obviously. But I think the concern that Survivor would have as a television product, because, of course, you and I and in other podcasts, I talk about TV and narrative and structure and edits and all of those things from the non-reality standpoint. But from the compelling storytelling standpoint, of course, Survivor wants that to be alive. And many times the votes are pretty made up. And people are pretty set. The tribal isn't live, and their job is difficult. The heavy lifting they have to do there is to make it seem like it's not the case, to make it seem like there is another option in play, whether it's an okie doke or whether they're trying to pull the wool over our eyes or what lengths they have to go to make that seem possible. That's where it becomes a little bit iffy with the editing in that respect. But most of the time they're having to do that. I think the idea that tribal is blindside heavy, that it's alive, that we're going to be able to, that's a much better consequence for them, I think, than having to deal with inevitability and having to deal with someone that's clearly going home and that there's no real drama in it. And I think you see that more in the pre-merge, obviously. Mm-hmm. And I think they're finding ways to shake that up. But I do think that it's not an easy job, and there are a lot of difficult things pulling them in different directions. I just think that we had a lot of boots this season where the story wasn't really told of the person who was getting booted. And the flip side of that, of course, is that you tell too much and then it's clear who's going home. So it's not an easy task, and it's certainly not an easy task in 40 minutes with commercials or whatever they get.
Right. I think they spent, you know, a decade and a half with pretty straightforward, you know, people would eventually get the death knell confessional and then you could just count them out that week. And then right around Survivor Philippines, I would say they started mixing it up. And I think I'm okay. Like, I'm good with that. I would much rather have it be the situation where the boot makes a little bit less sense, or maybe even a lot less sense, I guess, to me than it used to for the first few years when it was so obvious. But what I think they have been trying to avoid, and the reason that I focus so much on this is because I come in here and talk about the show and the game every single week, and from a game perspective, it makes it far less interesting when everything's going on in Survivor Worlds Apart, for instance, and nothing really matters, even though Mike's on the outs, because he's obviously going to run the table in the immunity challenge because he has to win based on the edit. Like, it deflates the entire purpose of studying what's even going on in the game.
Right. And let me use that to springboard into another question I have for you, which is that season Worlds Apart is another good example. Jeff comes out before the season, says, we're going to have a good season. You're going to really love this winner. And I think that caused a lot of people. By the way, that was one of the first seasons I've correctly picked the winner, because I read that directly and said, oh, well, this is probably going to be a certain type of person who's going to fit a certain mold. Like, I looked at the cast and I said, this is the guy I feel like Jeff is most sure about us liking. I feel like this is the winner. I felt like that was an easy pick. And I think a lot of us thought, like, okay, the fact that Jeff is hyping the winner for this season at a certain point in that season when everybody pretty much, once Shireen left, when everyone else had been insufferable to a certain extent, like it certainly, or made to seem insufferable, I'd certainly seemed like abundantly clear that that's what was going to happen with Mike, not just because of the edit, but because there's no way Jeff would have hyped the season like that if somebody they were burning on TV ended up winning the season. So I think they've struggled with that, because then when Jeff doesn't hype a season, we come out and say, well, can't be like someone like Suri winning this season, because Jeff has been always quiet on the Jeff front about how great a season this is. So there's no chance that Suri wins this. And I think that's where we were with this season. How do we fix that? Or do we fix it? Or can we fix it? Where we're reading Jeff's hype level and Jeff's promotion of the season as reflective on the winner, and that's causing us to know that Suri's not winning the season, even though they're giving Suri compelling content, even though Suri looked to be in a good place with like 7 left or 8 left that she could actually win this. We were all like, Suri 5%, 10%, that's it. How do we fix that if we're basing that on, well, Jeff would have hyped the season more if Suri won?
Yeah, I'm totally with you. I'm really glad you brought this up, because I think this is a big issue. It does seem like Jeff is pretty transparent. And at this point, it seems like we know the things Jeff would like or not like about how a season would play out, that it is pretty easy to read. And I think the way to get around this is Jeff has to come out and hype every single season, so that whether it's great, whether he loved it, or whether he didn't end up liking how it played out, we can't read into it. And it just seems like that's not on the table. But as far as like the game theory answer to this, as far as how Jeff balances his range, is hype all of them.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. I think that's a great observation.
If you're hyping all of them, we have no way of knowing.
Of course, the backlash on that is when you hype somebody who is a thrilled winner, then you lose the ability to say that your hype can generate more eyes or generate more interest. Like, oh, I better tune into Survivor this season because Jeff's hyping it. Once you hype somebody that you think the fans aren't going to love, then you have to do that. But I think the goal would be fix the game with the stuff like the Final Tribal, like they're doing. Continue to improve and evolve the game with things that they feel can continue to be improved and evolved, and give us as many glimpses as we can into what's going on out there, so that you aren't going to end up with a disappointing winner, so that we feel we're watching the television product that you showed us that makes us feel like the winner is deserving. Obviously, some seasons that's much easier than others, but it was fascinating to me that the solution to this seemed to be like, oh, well, we're going to give Aubrey a great edit. She's going to look like she's the one who's winning, and yet she loses. And that really frustrates a lot of people. So once you have expectations built to a certain point and those expectations change, that does cause, as you've noticed, an eruption in the fan base. So I think that's the difficult part of that.
No, I definitely I would agree with that for sure. And I wonder, let's get into a little bit just about Aubrey in general, now that you've brought her up, because where is she for you now as far as her legacy is concerned, after such a great run in Ko Rong and such a historic edit for like a losing finalist? I think certainly the fan favorite and probably like one of the most consensus top of the list, like robbed goddesses in Survivor history. She goes here, makes another finale, and is frankly barely on the show for the most part. What are you making of Aubrey now after seeing this?
My opinion hasn't really changed, because I think what we've seen from Aubrey, even in the first season, but certainly in this one to an extent, is that she thinks about the game from a really smart and strong place, that she's able to put things to bed. I think this season was great. Like every time she lost a lot of allies, Colin. She lost a lot of people, and she was on the wrong side of a lot of votes. She would come back and say, you know what? Great move, guys. Like, that was brilliant. You did a fantastic job. And I think the Aubrey's ability to take emotion out of it to an extent, to that extent, and still build relationships, still be well liked by people, I think that that's not seen as a pure game bot. I think that that's something that is really the strength of Aubrey's game, that she's able to think about it in the way that these really game heavy people can think about it. But she's also able to put aside a lot of the anger and frustration that come naturally when you're a really smart person like Spencer and you see the game through a certain lens. And it really upsets you when people aren't doing what you perceive to be logically their best interest. That's the sort of thing that really upsets you. That's the person if you're playing blackjack, right? When you're sitting next to a person who hits on 15 or whatever, and they get the card that you need. those people lose their minds, because how could you do this thing that was so against your interest? I love that Aubrey's able to put that aside and not be that person, even though she does think about the game from that perspective. She's the shoulder that Ty goes to cry on in this finale. So she still has that about her. And I love that about Aubrey. I would love to see Aubrey as many times as Aubrey wants to play. Has your opinion of her changed or evolved at all?
I would say it has gone up. I really feel like Aubrey being the belle of the ball in the world of Survivor weeks before this season went out and filmed, and watching all of those heavy hitters, like you mentioned, her closest allies all leaving so early, for her to get to run it this deep into the season, I think you're right. I think she has to just be one of, certainly on this season, and I would extend that to probably in recent memory on Survivor, one of the best like subtle social players of all time. It really stands out to me how she seems to be great at giving people whatever it is that they like, coming, meeting people where they are. I don't remember who initially framed it in those terms about her or about someone else, but it seems like that is, as far as I can tell, her greatest strength. It seems like she really is, with the exception of people like Kyle Jason or whatever, which I'm sure she can live without, pretty able to connect with a lot of people on their own terms.
Yeah, I love Aubrey Bracco. And, of course, a guy named Antonio Mazzaro is always going to love someone named Aubrey Bracco.
Yeah.
Just as like a non-starter, like, or as an instant. But I love her. Like, I just think she's really a great – I want to see players like Aubrey as much as possible. I want to see Aubrey as much as possible. I just – I think it's a great observation you're making about how she came into this game with what had to be one of the biggest targets on her back. And she found it difficult initially, I think, with some of these people who just looked at her as part of the Korong Four and said – you're here with three other people from your season. Like, you're, this is, I can't work with you. Sandra is the person I think who really was in that position. And Aubrey read this game and this, the composition of this cast so perfectly for her, the beginning of her game, when she realized, like, I need to play with these threats. And yet, talking to those threats, the fact that she even talked to Tony, she says, haunted her and hung over her all season, such that people never were able to really fully trust her. So I think this was a very difficult time for Aubrey to play Survivor. I hope that if Aubrey plays again, she's in a much better position where that sort of thing isn't going to be completely imputed against her and her character the entire time.
Yeah, I'm with you. I would love to see Aubrey back again. I hope have some more
Aubrey
time.
Bacco. Let's do it.
Yeah, let's make it happen. And you will be happy to know, by the way, she has a lovely giant Italian family that I got to meet during the premiere, and they were all fantastic. I think if she does end up coming back, Aubrey has now, she made it to what, day 39 and then day 36 or 37. I think she is a prime candidate to make it into that elusive three merges 100-day club.
Yep. And she should. Like, this is the kind of player Survivor should be bringing back. And if, to the extent that she wants it, because look, I know that both of her Survivor experiences were probably very draining for her in different ways. The first time she goes out, she plays a great game. We have what happens with the jury happen in that season. This time she goes out and literally she's having to reassess her situation in the game, like just every 3 days. And I'm sure that that had a huge emotional toll on how difficult it was for her to play this time around. So I hope that she does come back, and she comes back in happier times and a bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, bushy-haired, ready to do this.
Yeah, I think Aubrey's great at just something we try to talk about often, because it really seems like the show makes the winner's games often look really glowing and almost mistake-free. A lot of things aren't going to go your way on a day-to-day basis out there on Survivor, and I think Aubrey is like an all-time champion at understanding that it didn't go her way and reassessing and trying to pick it up from there and move on.
Yep, love it, love it, love it. I just the more Aubrey, the better. And yeah, she really, that is a key component of what she does, and yeah, and rolling with the punches. So I'd love to see that. I think Aubrey and winning Survivor are the all-time misconnection right now. So let's make that happen, Colin.
Yeah, although there may be one other person at the top of people's list after this final
Tribal
Council. Yeah, Antonio.
You don't say.
Let's get into that. Yeah, we have, before I guess we get into Cerise specifically, let's talk just about the Advantage Geddon, as it's become known, at this final six. We had, of course, the three idols, the Legacy Advantage, Brad with the Immunity Necklace, and that just meant only Cerise was eligible to leave, even though still no one in the entire game had ever cast a vote for her. Antonio, I know this is Survivor Game Changers, but is this too much game changing for you if this kind of stuff is happening?
To an extent, yeah. I think that the flaw with that is that all of these, the bells are tolling right around the same time. I don't mind. I'm a big player of games myself. I like board games. I like strategy games. I just love all these things that have intricacies about them and different rules you can use or different roles. Pandemic is one of my favorites because everybody in that game has a different role, and each different role has a different tool, and the game can change every time depending on who's around. And so I don't mind having these different advantages in play. I would prefer them to be, you know, maybe this one has to be played by 9. This one has to be played by 8 or 7 or whatever. As long as that there is not this, which is what happened in play, which is where they all get played at once and all the chickens come home to roost at once. And a person whose hands were pretty clean and was probably not even in the top 3 of people who should have or would have been sent home in that episode goes home. That's when it becomes a little frustrating. I think it's anytime you're making history this late into your run, I think that there's a question of like what's going on. So my question for you is, how do you feel the game looks different if some of these advantages are introduced, but they have different timelines on them? Do you think that's a way to fix this?
I think that's a great idea. I think that's the perfect way to fix this is, hey, guess what, gang? Idols expire at final 7 now, and we can avoid this if we never have more than 3 idols in the game.
Yeah, or you got your pre-merge idol, it actually expires at final 7. If you find an idol post-merge, or maybe, you know, vice versa, like maybe you have different idols with different rules, and maybe the legacy advantage isn't just an immunity idol. Like maybe there's some better way to play that, or maybe that's more public, that legacy advantage. So I think that there are ways to do this. Think about heroes versus villains or these seasons where the idol becomes a major, major factor, right? And the people's response to the idol, the fact that people are looking for a thing or it's clear. I mean, nowadays, Ty can make it very abundantly clear that he's going out looking for idols, and it doesn't seem to be chasing him around. So I think people have just accepted these things as part of the game, and they're not really pushing back against them or their use anymore. And it's evolved to the point where players are counting on them possibly being around. It causes a lot of vote splits, but I think we'd have a lot more live stuff if these things had different shelf lives. So you're saying end them all at 7.
Just mix it up. Maybe end. I can't imagine they would end if 3 different people find 3 idols on day 1 on 3 different beaches. Those, I would guess, all have the same shelf life.
Right.
But have the legacy advantage expire earlier. Have something where there is no theoretical way for everyone to be immune or everyone but one person or whatever. Like, I will happily accept that they had no way of expecting this kind of thing to happen. This is a total fluke kind of scenario for 5 out of 6 people to be immune, but it's still possible.
Yeah, one of my friends, his name is Bryant. He's a brilliant guy. He's a lawyer, but he's more of a Survivor casual than you or I. And he pointed out, like, what happens at Final 6 if they, you know, there wasn't a clear target? Like, let's say Aubrey doesn't. I'm not sure ultimately what the rules were, right? Like, because I don't know. I haven't really talked it out. But the situation was Suri goes home because no one else was eligible to get a vote. Like, they could re-vote till the cows come home. But normally in a tie scenario. So let's say Ty doesn't play the idol on Aubrey. Suri and Aubrey get 3 votes each for whatever reason because they're the only people who can receive votes. They each vote for each other, and it's split in terms of how that plays out. At that point, the traditional tiebreaker scenario is that the people who are left in the game and who can receive votes go to rocks. We saw that boomerang back very negatively in the Keith Nail scenario and everything that played out in that crazy tribal with the whiteboard and all of that previously. But I'm wondering, what's the scenario here? Do they just go to fire? Do Suri and Aubrey just go to fire if there's a tie at 6 and the other 4 are immune and can't receive votes?
That would be my guess, just because I can't imagine they would open the door for someone to like win the immunity necklace and still leave at that tribal council.
Right.
I can't imagine that's in play.
Or save an idol all game and only play it then, only to go home. It has to be, right, that the two of them would go into some kind of fire-making
show. I would imagine so. But you brought up an interesting idea of just what does the casual fan think about this tribal council in general?
I don't have a great finger on the pulse. I feel like, generally speaking, it depends on who gets hurt. Because think of the other kind of game-changing thing that happened this season when Malcolm goes home and how ridiculous and angry people were upset about that. People are going to be upset no matter how Malcolm went home. But that Malcolm went home because of a quote-unquote game-changing twist. I do think that that upset people. And certainly the fact that Suri goes home here, I'm sure, upset casual fans. I think among the more hardcore fans, we all kind of saw it coming. Like, we all thought this is where it was going to go when you see the people that were going to have advantages and idols in play there and how everything blew up. It just seemed like, okay, Suri or Aubrey is going to get beat down at Advantage Geddon. Mm-hmm. And so I think the key to happiness is low expectations, right? So, like, I do think that was part of it. But for the casuals, I don't know that they'd lowered their expectations. They were probably pretty upset. I don't know. Have you gone to the Survivor Facebook page recently, Colin?
It's my homepage, Antonio. I'm actually browsing it right now and not even really listening to what you're saying.
So, you Frinkers are on the pulse of the average American. Have you seen any feedback or heard any negative? I haven't seen any or heard any backlash in this regard, but to be fair, I've siloed myself against it.
Likewise. I would imagine, like you're saying, that it is very dependent on who the victim, in air quotes, kind of is of those twists. And probably with both Malcolm and Ceri, I'm guessing the Survivor Facebook page is not where you want to be this time. Or maybe in a finale it won't be as bad when everyone's like happy for Sarah. But I can't imagine they were too thrilled about that. And I wonder if maybe even because it was Ceri in particular who was the victim of this, what kind of impact do you think this will actually have? Do you think we'll show up to season 35 and there will be no Legacy Advantage?
Possibly, because the Legacy Advantage is something, it's not quite Medallion of Power level, like it wasn't killed in the season it was introduced in, but this is a newer thing, so it's possible. They got some good drama out of it. It is clearly the difference maker in Sarah's game. I think she would point to that. I know she has. I know others have. Like her move of basically having a good enough social relationship with Sierra that when Sierra was at her lowest ebb and felt like I have no opportunity or option to advance in this game, I got to spill to somebody. I'm going to spill to Sarah to try to build trust. Like the fact that she spilled to the very person that then turned around and used it against her and got it willed to her was clearly the key moment of Sarah's game. So the Legacy Advantage had legs this time around. It mattered. And I think if you're the people that wanted the Legacy Advantage to exist, if you created it, if you wanted it in the game, I think you could point to this and say, success, like it worked. But then you could point to the Ceri Tribal Council and be like, did it work? Like, yeah. Is that really what we wanted? And by the way, as I'm talking, I went to the Survivor Facebook page, watched the jaw-dropping Survivor Game Changer season finale top post. The top comment, 529 responses on this comment or reactions. This comment, Ceri's boot was unfair. Unless you're drawing rocks, if your name isn't written down, you shouldn't be voted out. There should have been a double elimination, Colin, at the next tribal, or just an extra tribal council, Colin, added, and no one was voted out this time around. Hopefully this is a wake-up call to production to stop putting so many idols and advantages in play. Ceri is a legend and deserved better.
Send it to Samoa, Antonio.
Send it to Samoa. That's the top comment. And I should say Johnny Patella is the person whose comment that is. I don't want to get accused of just not giving him a citation there. So
what's the Patella? Is the Patella the shoulder or something?
Patella, I believe, is a tendon in your knee.
Okay.
But so this is Johnny Knees. And the number one comment with 59 likes in response is, that's the game. Like, I don't know. So 529 people, Colin. This is certainly a hot button for the casuals, I'm sure. And like I said, I do think it's results oriented. I think if Troyzan goes out there, and no offense to Troyzan, I don't want to get blocked, but if Troyzan goes out there and not Ceri, I'm not sure you have the same response. Though Troyzan does have his fans, there's no question about it. Like, I just don't think it's the same thing. But still, results oriented doesn't matter. Like, it should be that it's wrong if it's anybody. And I feel like this is a very difficult scenario. I know that Survivor likes the big moment on TV, but I'm not sure this isn't at the expense of the game. I think it needs to be tweaked just slightly so that this sort of scenario doesn't happen.
Yeah, I think it would be fine with me if we gave the Legacy Advantage some time off. And then I have always been a big proponent of, if we want to put it in there, have Jeff announce that it's in there and have people wondering who has it at the beginning of the game. But sidebar, Antonio, you're not blocked by Troyzan. What are you doing right? How did you pull this off?
I generally try to live a nice lifestyle, Colin. Try to be a good person. And I also try to not talk about Troyzan on Twitter. So those are three things really serve me well.
Yeah. Well, Antonio, you the other day had a twist idea that I thought was really interesting. So can you divulge a little bit about that if you'd be so inclined? Because I thought this was really cool, just in the spirit of new twists that they may be, if they're looking for new twists, this may be a good idea.
Yeah, and this is the thing. You don't have to introduce a twist and then say you can keep it until six, right? You can introduce a twist and say, this has to be played at the next tribal after you find it. And we've seen them do that. Like, we have seen them introduce things or use advantages that come into play right away. And so my suggestion is, like, this isn't necessarily one of them, but that would be the first thing. But the second thing is, I don't have a problem then, if you're doing that, adding more fun to the game with things like this. And I've decided in the days after the Survivor finale that I would call this the informed voter advantage.
Oh, nice. I like it.
Yeah, what that lets you do, if you've got the informed voter advantage, everybody, Jeff says, all right, let's do it. Let's cast, you know, let's vote. There's nothing left to talk about. At that point, you stand up and you say, Jeff, I've got the informed voter advantage. And what this is going to let me do is I get to vote last. I get to vote after everyone has. And I get to see how everyone has voted before I cast my vote. So this would be like final seven or some. You could, the key moment would be when you're not sure about where the votes are going and you're not sure if you should put your vote on person A or person B, or you just don't have a good read on it. You play this advantage, you see where the votes are, and then maybe it doesn't work. Maybe it doesn't matter. Maybe it's an 8-0 vote and everybody's on the same page, but maybe it does matter and you have the opportunity to cast a vote in a way that will make an impact. And I guess maybe what they don't want to do is, they don't want to add advantages which have a low return. That, okay, the times when that would work are a lot lower than the times that it, or a lot lower than the times that it wouldn't. And maybe that's the case with this one. I haven't really thought that through, but I don't have a personal problem with that. I don't have a personal problem with playing advantages that they don't really matter. Like, the legacy advantage didn't matter for Ken at all. I don't have a problem with an advantage being in the game that doesn't have a big impact. Because sometimes it could, and I'm okay with that. What do you think about an advantage like that?
I definitely like it. I think what the hidden immunity idol does well, and the reason that it's been around so long, is it's not so inherently powerful that it's just automatic protection and it's impossible to mess up, kind of like the original hidden immunity idol was, or the Tyler Perry idol that Tony got. But if you do time it well, it can make a big difference. And I think with this kind of informed voter thing, especially if these new tiebreaker rules stay in place, I think this could get used more effectively than you may initially be inclined to think, where I think if someone's just trying to avoid a tie, this is a good way to go. If they're the swing vote, or if they're they're trying to figure out, maybe they're getting blindsided and they need to know which way to play their idol or whatever, I think there is a lot of value in this kind of thing, but definitely not so much that it's overpowered.
Oh, I hadn't even thought about that aspect of it, which is that you could also have an immunity idol in your pocket when you play this advantage, and so you could actually see that I'm going home tonight, and then use that informed voter advantage to see that, then play your idol or know who to play your idol on. Like, even if you weren't going to play it for yourself, if you were like, I'm not sure if I should play this for person A or person B, it could be OP almost at that point. It could be overpowered if combined with an idol. It's like, maybe that's why they don't let you use coupons on, like, you can't use 15 of the same coupon on one item, so that they have to give you $3 and the item. Like, maybe that they wouldn't let you combine it with another thing, but still, I think as an alliance, that would give you a lot of power, and you could probably find a way to massage that. Maybe you could make some rules that impact that. But I hadn't even thought of it in conjunction with idols. That's fascinating.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a lot of merit to this idea. I'm in on the informed voter rule. I'm unofficially sending it to Samoa. I don't have the jurisdiction to do so, but I'm sending it to Samoa.
Doesn't count without a bell, but I'll take it. I'll take it. For me, it can. Oh, look, we have a bell there? What's going on?
It's a long story.
Yeah, okay, fantastic. It's not like you don't have your own place where you could tell a long story. That's too bad.
I play a lot.
You don't have to tell the story. You don't have to tell the story.
No, it's a quick. I play a lot of online backgammon, and the bell is a nice motivator. This is no lie. I had never taken it out of my closet between I got this bell because I thought it would be hilarious to have a bell when we interviewed Rob Cesternino like 5.5 years ago. I took it out of my closet like 6 months ago to use as like a backgammon motivational tool.
And how does that work? Is it like Pavlov's, like, what are you ringing the bell and then making a move? Or does it, you signify that in your time, or how does that work?
It's when you hit a lucky roll, you ding the bell.
Oh, I like it. I like it. Like a good tip at a bar.
Right, exactly.
I'm with that. I like that. I like that a lot.
I can't believe I had it sitting right here when you said that.
No, but
that's,
now
that's
I know
very
why.
Embarrassing.
No, it's not. It's fantastic. And I like that. I'm going to get one too, and I'm going to find some way to make it count. But generally speaking, I just think that if we're going to add advantages to the game, I don't have a problem with that. I would prefer that they not be advantages that make half the or more of the people that are left immune.
Yeah.
I think that's my biggest problem with it. I would prefer more strategic and time-specific advantages and less immunity advantages generally.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely with that. I think the immunities, they're handing them out like hotcakes these days, Antonio. It's too much. What do you think inspired all of these twists? Was it what made them feel like there wasn't enough of this kind of thing going on?
That's a good question. It's probably because of you and the genius would be my guess. I don't know. I would say that part of it is that they trust their audience more now. I think they know what their core is. I think they're in a really good position in terms of the production of the show. I think that all the landscape of TV has changed so drastically in the last several seasons of television or several years. And I think Survivor, to a certain extent, even though the numbers are lower, they are not lower by the percents that other shows are lower, and the TV viewership in general, in terms of the ratings, has gone down. So I think Survivor trusts its audience. They know their audience better. I think they're in a position where they're making the show from that standpoint, and not necessarily from a standpoint where they really feel like they have to try to increase the number, or they have to try to make something happen where they're going to get new. I think they can trust the audience now to put these advantages in play and really have them stacking up. And I think the idea of Game Changers opened their wallets a little bit as well. It really made them feel like, okay, let's do this thing. But I like that they did that. I like that they opened their notebook, and I'm upset on some level that we didn't get to see, for example, Debbie take the idol making kit, because I think Cochran said there were at least three fake idols worth of fake idol materials in that kit. So I like the idea that you could actually see the game alive with game stuff, with strategy, with these advantages, with rules and things like that. The more they trust their audience, I think the more we're going to see that.
Is Survivor still winning Wednesday nights across television?
Generally speaking, I think so. And certainly in their time slot, and I think in certain demographic areas. I don't know if it had the highest raw number across the board all season long. The times I checked, it was, but that's not to say that it wasn't. But I think the numbers were down this season over season, and I think that they were probably a little frustrated with that. I don't know that for a fact, but I'm sure that that was the case. But as I said, all I know is what I've seen on record, and Mark Burnett is on record with Josh after this finale basically saying, like, the numbers for Survivor are great. In many respects, they're up, and they're certainly higher than other shows which have bled natural numbers in this changing era of television. So it seems pretty rosy for Survivor right now. I mean, look, I'm a fan of The Amazing Race, also on CBS. The Amazing Race has been on hospice care, ultimately, for multiple seasons. Like, people have written the obituary of The Amazing Race over and over and over again, and it just got renewed. So these shows are not what a scripted show is to make. They have their built-in audiences. They have loyal audiences. The audiences support things. So I think if people are concerned about Survivor, they really shouldn't be. Even if the people who make Survivor wanted to be doing better than it is, which I don't know that they do, we shouldn't as fans be concerned at all. Survivor will end when Jeff wants it to, I think, is the takeaway that I have. When Jeff wants to step away, that will be when Survivor probably reaches its end.
Oh, you don't think it could go or would even try to go on after Jeff?
I don't know. I guess it's possible. The other thing that's a good nugget from that Mark Burnett talk that that Josh had with Jeff as well is that they really have – Jeff is the star of the show. He's the showrunner. Like, he's the EP. He's the guy who is running the thing and starring in the thing, and that is pretty rare in TV. So I think that if you take Jeff away from the starring role, I think that maybe you could put another host in there, although I don't think they would be as good as Jeff. That's not to say they couldn't eventually get there. But I think if you take Jeff away from the executive producer role and all of that, I mean, do multiple people move at that point? I mean, I don't know what happens, but I feel like that changes things significantly. My take would be that Survivor ends when Jeff wants it to.
Okay, I think that's probably the consensus view at this point. Are you okay with that, with Survivor ending with Jeff?
Yeah, I'm okay with that. I'm okay with that. I mean, I don't have any insider knowledge on this. I obviously don't know Jeff Probst. I don't get anything that the public doesn't get about what Jeff is saying or the inside feelings on Survivor. That's my personal feeling, and I think I'm basing that in part on the fact that that feels right to me. Like, that feels to me like the time the show should end. I don't think we should transition into a new host. I don't want to see that personally. I worry everything that would change if Jeff stepped away. So I think the when Jeff is done making the show, that should be it for Survivor.
Okay, well, the good news is he doesn't age, so we're fine.
Yeah, exactly. He's like Dick Clark. Like, we're going to have this. Jeff's going to be hosting Survivor at 90 and look very much like he does now.
Yeah, Jeff Probst rocking Survivor finale.
Exactly. When is the ball going to drop on season 76?
Yeah. Antonio, before we close on Advantage Geddon, I think we certainly should talk about losing Ciri. And this is something that just in thinking over the last few days since the finale, I'm really wondering if Ciri might be my pick as the greatest Survivor player of all time. Like, not the greatest non-winner of all time, the greatest Survivor player of all time, just in, as far as her highlight reel and just the conversations it seems like she is able to pull off with even really, really strong players. I am someone who views Survivor as a game that is not like a tennis tournament or like chess, where if you're the best player in the field, you should win pretty much every single time. To me, it's much more like a poker tournament where you could do literally every single thing right and still lose over and over and over again. And it's really just about putting yourself in a position to succeed when things break your way. I feel like we've seen Ciri do that every single time, including Heroes versus Villains, where I think she just got chopped early, and had she not been chopped so early, was still at the forefront of a solid Heroes alliance, seemed to be calling the shots there. And she just has, and of course the other three times, come very close and just not had things break her way. Where do you stand on that? Am I crazy for feeling like she is someone in that very, very upper echelon?
I don't think you're crazy. I think that that has been the opinion of her for a long time.
She hasn't won,
respects.
Though, Antonio. She's doing something wrong if she's never won.
Yeah, right. That's results-oriented thinking, and I know it's not your opinion. I heard the sarcasm in your tone, Colin. I'm with you, generally speaking, on this. This was the opinion generally of her, like I said, before this season. She didn't do anything this season to change it negatively. She only enhanced it, as far as I'm concerned. We saw some masterful work with Ciri. We saw Ciri get through to certain players or to do certain things that other players were really struggling doing. I really think that that Ciri socially, and I think because of who she is as a person, because of what she's experienced, she would tell you, and she has said, like, I'm an everyday person. I didn't go to Harvard. I'm not an ex-professional athlete. And I'm certainly not turning my nose up at those people, and I know she isn't. But I think generally speaking, who she is as a person makes it easier for her to commune with multiple different kinds of people. And then her job. She's talked about how she's like a high-stress administrative nurse, essentially, in an ER setting where she has to deal with and run the entire op room. Like, she has to run who's doing what and when and whose egos are in play, and she has to balance all those things. And so Survivor, in many ways, is like a vacation from her in that respect.
They're less stressed on Survivor than in an ER.
A million times, because, you know, no one's life is at stake at the end of the day. Like, this is, if she's not in an op, whether it's ER or op room, she's in a room where surgery is occurring, and where I'm sure if she is behaving or doing her job the wrong way, people will die. And I think you take that and you make that job a person who has to balance the egos of doctors, and you have to deal with nurses, and you have to deal with people of all different kinds of backgrounds and intelligence levels or education levels or wisdom levels. I think she's very well poised to do well at Survivor. The thing that holds her back is, of course, the physical aspect. I think part of the problem is when I said earlier that we were looking at this and we were informed and we were in the loop and saying Ciri just doesn't have a shot. Ciri just has no potential to do what Brad did, which is win these immunities when he needed to. So Ciri can't even – I don't even think – you look at Ciri at Final Four, I'm thinking they're probably going to cut Ciri no matter who the other three are, unless it's like Michaela and maybe Sarah. So at that point, like, how does Ciri make it to the Final Three unless she wins that Final Four immunity? And I just don't know that she's ever going to be able to do that. Like, I think that is the real drawback of Ciri's game. So she's maybe a plus 10 in the social game and a plus 10 in the strategic game, but she's a 1 in the physical game. And I think that when you talk about overall players, best players, is there another player who's an 8 across the board or a 7 across the board? Is that why everyone's so high, even though I'm not, on Kim Spradlin? Like, is that what everybody loves about her, is Kim is not only really good at the social and strategic aspects, but she's actually a decent physical player. She can win a challenge. Like, is that the difference? I don't know. But for me, I Ciri was my winner pick this season, and I didn't care that she was going to come into this game with a huge target on her back, because I thought to myself, like, okay, taking everything else out of the equation, taking all these pregame alliances and everything else everyone's talking about and Jeff hype and everything else, like, who is the player who among these people I want to stake my claim is the most likely to have their skills be rewarded by winning Survivor. So I picked Saria, and I still think I was right to do that. And I would do that on just about every season going forward. Do you think her physical game is too much of a drawback? And is that going to prevent her from ever winning this game, Colin?
Yeah, you're right. I think the problem is, especially when she's now Saria 3.0 and 4.0, and in the future, maybe even 5.0, hopefully, is everyone knows she is a huge threat that Saria 1.0, people don't necessarily know that about, and they aren't as concerned about taking her to the end, whereas I think on these future shots, they may very well be. And to address like what her plan I think may have been, it seemed to me like the idea was Sarah was going to leave there at Final Six, if you know, without the legacy advantage, and I would suspect that Saria was hoping Aubrey would be her Final Four buffer, which I think is a perfect person to have there, especially if the people you're trying to convince are like Ty and Troyzan of, hey, 4 weeks ago, this girl was all America could talk about was how robbed she was. How could you possibly sit with her in the end? And in Ty's case, again.
Yeah, and with all the people that she had previously aligned with sitting on the jury, like people that she, you know, the Grim Reaper had struck down. So I do, not all the people, but certainly a lot of people. And I do think that that's part of it.
Well, to go back to her physical aspect, though, sorry, yes, that is a big difference maker for me. Like if I were to have the gun to my head and I have to pick one player out of all these survivors that have ever played to play a season against other random players, and if they lose, that trigger's getting pulled and I die, I would still take Kim Spradlin just because I think they are very, very close, both socially and strategically, by which I mean the two best ever. And then I think I don't think Kim just won a couple challenges. Kim won like three or four immunities at the end of that. I think she's tremendously capable in the challenges and winning her way into the finals if she needs to. Whereas with Saria, it really does seem like that's off the table. And furthermore, Saria has just a much higher chance of getting voted out before the merge because she's a physical liability.
What is the fundamental difference in terms of, because what I would say about Kim is small sample size. I would say, your data set is too small for me to know how she would do when she was known as a player, whereas I know how Saria can do as a player. But what I'm curious is a comparison between Andrea 3.0 and Kim Spradlin, where Andrea is a challenge beast. She is somebody who's playing a good social game. She's liked, she's got alliances, she's built herself a good core, but she probably peaks too soon in that regard. She makes her big move, she sticks her neck out, and it puts her in a position where she gets burned. She is seen by Zeke as running the game, and Zeke is a smart player, so he knows who's running the game. And unlike Troyzan in Survivor 1 world, Zeke has people he can talk to about this sort of thing. There are receptive people in the audience who can see a person like Andrea or Kim as a threat and not see them as somebody who's just their best friend ever and they just want to reward with the money. Kim was not playing with replacement level survivors in that season. She was playing with below replacement level survivors. Freaking Troyzan is like the best person on that season. So I don't understand what the difference between what people's views of a returning Kim would be versus people's views of a returning Andrea would be.
First of all, give me Jonas over Troyzan all day, just for the record.
Fair enough.
It is a good point, but what it comes down to for me is Andrea, not just Andrea 3.0, but it seemed to me based on the TV show, all three versions of Andrea, while she was for a long time like respected and trusted, people always at the back of their mind knew she's scheming and scamming and up to no good and I need to get rid of her eventually. Is that inconsistent to you? Whereas for me, yes, I will happily grant Kim was playing against probably the weakest cast of all time, maybe Redemption Island. So it's hard to really have an adequate understanding of just how good she would be against top level players or even just average players. But I just feel like not only seeing her on the show, but having talked to her and, you know, was pathetic within 5 minutes of that, how just charmed I was. And then also hearing her on other podcasts and seeing her on interviews and et cetera, it really feels to me like she just puts people at ease. And I think that is why she is so good at Survivor. And I don't think that would change on a return shot.
Yeah, and I guess I would say like you the person who's that good at doing that, if you're among a cast of people who are smart, you recognize that person is a threat. Like, okay, that person who is friends with people and that person who puts people at ease, or that person who people are willing to work with at any time or whatever, that person is a threat for that skill. And I think that's the part that's not sure. What I would say about Andrea, and she never put people at ease in her first two seasons, I was not a big fan of her game. I like Andrea as a person a ton, but I was not a fan of her game her first two seasons because she was so uneasy, because she was so skittish and anxious and nervous. And I think that that really annoyed me on the island, is her constantly worrying and worrying and worrying. She'll tell you, and she did in her exit interviews, that her problem this season was that she didn't worry enough, that she was too confident, that she got out in front of it. So Kim is very clearly a different player than Andrea in that respect. Kim is very comfortable in her own strategic skin in that regard. I just think that the skills that make Kim so beloved and so skilled, clearly as a person and as a winner, could easily be seen by someone like Zeke or others as a threat and as something that needed to be dealt with on a season with returning players. So that would be fascinating to me. And I'm not questioning Kim's decision to start a family and do everything that she's done in the aftermath of her win, but it's rather convenient that she hasn't come back to defend her crown. And it's easy for us to now say best winner ever. I also should point out, you brought up Redemption Island. A lot of people say Boston Rob played the best winner game ever on that season. And so it's fascinating to me that two of the people that are atop most winner lists played with the worst cast. So maybe we should be considering that their game looked better because of the people they were playing against. And I'm not sure we're giving that enough of a factor as we are. And this whole conversation, it revolves around Ciri. The toughest game I think Ciri has played is Heroes versus Villains, where clearly she came in with a reputation. Clearly her reputation, even though she too is very confident and comfortable putting people at ease, talking to people. I mean, she puts Eric Reichenbach such at ease. Look what he does. But she's also in a position where she is a killer. Gangster in an Oprah suit is what Shane called her, because that's the skill set. It's I can be like lovable and I can be putting you at ease, and I'm a gangster underneath that. I think that is the skill set of Ciri Fields. When she comes into Heroes versus Villains, that's why she's targeted. And I think that even though it takes like fire to get her out of the game, and not fire in the literal sense, but she literally has to be killed with fire. Like it has to be a backward scenario to eliminate Ciri Fields. She was targeted in her worst game because of that skill set. So I do think it's possible that on a returning player season, that's what gets exposed for players like Kim, is that even though they're nice and putting people at ease and they're really good at getting people to believe that they're on the same page with them, that for certain people is a very threatening thing. And so it's a different conversation with do you bring Ciri back and does she have a great chance to win a returning player season? Or if you take Ciri out of the equation, we're running a sim on a Survivor season with their skill set, with players who have never heard of them, and an average level player season, Kim is going to dominate those seasons. She's going to do really well in those scenarios. But and so is Ciri, I think. I really think so is Ciri, ultimately. So I don't know. I think it's a fascinating conversation to have. It's all fantasy. It's all in our heads. You're asking, is Ciri the best of all time? I think it's a conversation we can have at that point, even though she's not won it, because as you say, it's more like poker in that you get to the table, you do everything right, and it's not your fault you didn't win. I do think that that's the case with Ciri a couple of times, and especially that final two that ended up being a final two instead of a final three.
Yeah.
So I do think that she's had some really hard luck, that this conversation would be a lot different if Ciri had a couple W's under her belt for reasons that were not her fault.
Yeah. I don't want to dive too deep into this, but if you are feeling like just Kim's average opponent skill level, like her degree of difficulty isn't, is historically low, where does she fall for you among, like, I know you don't have winner rankings, but like, where would you consider her? Like, if you had the gun to your head, how many picks would it take for you to pick her?
She's top 10 for sure, unquestionably. And is she top 5? That's the part where I start to struggle. I think the takeaway from a season like this, for example, where Sarah freaking Lucina, the merge boot of Cagayan, comes out and wins this season. And wins this season, by the way, playing only slightly differently. She's in the same position she's in Cagayan. The problem is in Cagayan, she's in that position and she burns it. She handles it really poorly. In this season, she flipped and it didn't stick to her because she was playing a little better. So her positionally, she was very similar, but she changed the tone just slightly and it made a huge difference for her. But what I'm saying about that is, how does that not change the way we look at someone like Tony as his win? When people from his season go out and dominate or do really, really well, high level success or other finals appearances like Spencer or the things that people from Cagayan have gone on and done, how can you undersell Tony's win in the moment, knowing what we know now with the evidence that we have? And I point to someone who was Spradlin-esque as an example of this. Derek from Big Brother. A lot of people said, well, Derek ran a season where nobody went out and did anything. He was running against he was clearly the head of the class. And then Nicole from Derek's season comes out and wins a Big Brother season. So doesn't that improve the way we look at Derek? Shouldn't we look at Tony's win better? Doesn't that decrease the way we look at Kim? I mean, that, for me, it does. I understand that it doesn't for other people. I'm probably picking Kim about fifth or sixth or seventh or eighth. But certainly in the top 10 as a result of this, just because I think that her game was great. I think that her skills are great, but I think she executed it against a very low level of competition. So it's hard for me. I'm not going to award the Major League Baseball MVP to a guy who dominates at AAA, even though that guy, like Mike Trout, might come up to the big leagues and dominate in the big leagues right away. I'm not saying Kim's win was over AAA competition, but I'm trying to use that as a metaphor. And I hope I'm not going to get pitchforks.
It was like Babe Ruth baseball competition.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it was lower than AAA. I don't know. If you want to take that, if you want to make that your stance, go for it. I'm just saying, ultimately, that is a major factor for me, that I can't ignore that when I'm looking at Kim's skill set. If you run it against a replacement-level season, I think Kim would do incredibly well. And that's why I think she's one of the best players to ever play Survivor. But saying she's the best winner ever, I just think we can't do that based on this one season against, like, subpar Survivor talent. And yeah. Maybe not. Maybe it was the edit. Maybe the people out there were really gaming hard. I mean, look. Those guys were bending over backwards to send themselves home for crying out loud. Like, it was just not like the best season at all. Troy Zan has to make a case to somebody, and he's making it to Kat Ederson, Colin. Like, that's who Troy Zan had to rely on as, like, the best player left in the game that he might be able to get some traction with. Some of that's because Kim locked down the key people, and some of that's because Kim was able to send home some of the key people, unquestionably. But there are some real dodos on that season, and Kim feasted on those dodos, and they're extinct, hopefully, from Survivor going forward.
Can you imagine if you put, like, Fishback or Rob Cisternino out there in that Troy Zan spot, like, as Kim just has everyone else hypnotized, like, the amount of hair they would pull out?
Yeah, I mean, we saw what happened with Troy Zan. Like, Troy Zan went nuts, and so, yeah, Troy Zan seems like a pretty chill guy, generally speaking.
Still a lot of hair, though. He kept a lot of his hair.
Kept a lot of his hair, yeah. Didn't go crazy on that. Yeah. That's my big issue is that I've seen winners execute against players who I felt were playing better than the players who played. But what do I know? I only watched an edited version of the show. But you know what? So did we all. So maybe we should all take that with a little bit of a grain of salt and say, from what I saw, wasn't too many people out there playing that game. So yeah, she dominated it, but against whom? And I think that's what I would ultimately say, because you could look at Sarah Lucina and say Sarah strategically, like, dominated this game. She ran it. So why isn't she getting as much love as Kim? Like, just because it was harder for her? It should have been harder for her. It was all returning players.
Yeah.
So I don't really know. I don't really know. Just because it's harder for somebody doesn't mean that they're not as good of a winner, because if it was harder for them because they were playing against really good people, that should count. That should count.
With kind of that in mind, I'm wondering if this is someone in that handful of names that you might pick ahead of Kim, someone under similar circumstances, but I think who pulled it off like a phenomenal social game against a much stronger cast. Earl Cole, is he up there for you?
Yes, for sure. And I think Kim and Earl are very similar. Like, I think that Earl is probably somebody who I would slot right above Kim or right at the same slot. Like, I think that they're very similar. The most impressive thing about Earl for me is how he was just a last minute addition to that cast. Mm-hmm. So you pluck this guy out of his normal life. He wasn't a big Survivor fan at the time.
He had never seen the show until like 2 days. He watched a little bit of Cook. He watched like 3 episodes of Cook Islands on his way out or whatever.
Yeah. And that's insane to me that he comes out and does what he does. So yeah, I think that I would love to see Kim and Earl both. I would love to see them play again and give us some more data points on what their skill sets are and how really well served their skill sets are. My guess is that even more so than Kim, if Earl plays again, people would say, who? Like, who is this guy? Like, he was even on Survivor. He won it. Like, not a very beloved season for sure. And very similar in terms of, there were some decent, Yao Man's a very good player, for example. Like, there are some decent players out there.
Alex Angarita, very historically slept on. I've said that before and people think I'm kidding.
I laughed because I thought you were kidding. You may be right. You may be right. You know, I don't know. There's a lot of ugliness in that season, and it's a difficult rewatch. I've only seen it twice, but yeah, I would say at the end of the day, very similar. And I would love to see them both play again because I would love to see their skill sets on display. I think they're both very talented players.
Yeah. Let's transition a little bit into the reunion and et cetera. And while we're now that we've seen these people back on the stage, another person that's very high up on my list that I'm just curious about, and we'll get into the specifics of the reunion and this season and more quickly. But just while we're here, Tony, what did you make of Tony after the end of this season? Has anything changed for him?
Man, do you think he could have played any differently? Like, do you think that Tony could have come out and chilled out? Or do you think that it was just too hot coming in for him? Like, was he drawing dead when he stepped onto that beach, Colin?
I would imagine so. It seems to me like if he was in there under the impression that doing things like running off for the idol as soon as they hit the beach and everyone's talking about shelter or food or whatever, and he says, all right, cool, nice to meet you, I'm gonna go find the idol, it really seems like Tony just had the wrong state of mind to be playing in this game. And we hit on it earlier with Aubrey when we were talking about her, like, just the mere willingness to talk to Tony became like a stain on her throughout the entire season. I don't think he had any chance.
Yeah, and that was my impression too, and I feel like you've basically articulated that throughout the season, the times that it's come up. But I feel like if that's the case, as a fan of Survivor, I'm glad he went out and just played like he did. Like, don't, you know what? If you feel like you have no shot, just go make us some good TV and have fun. And he wasn't the first boot, Colin, so it could have been worse, right? Like, it could have been worse. But, you know, Sierra herself, as being the first boot, was also drawing dead in that respect, I think. Like, nothing Sierra could have done would have taken the target she had off of her back. I think it's fascinating, though, that how a season can change our viewpoints on somebody, right? Because I know you, for example, had a lot of good things to say about Sandra this season, having not really said them before. And we started to see Sandra 3.0 emerging in a way that Sandra 1.0 and 2.0 hadn't popped in as clear of a way. And so it's silly, I think, to think that a returning player season couldn't change a perspective and doesn't change our perspectives and doesn't cause us to overrate or underrate certain players when maybe it's not fair to do that. And I would say that about Tony. I don't think we should take any shine off of Kagyan just because of how he played this time around. I've rewatched some of Kagyan recently just throughout. Like, I went back and watched Sarah's boot episode. In earlier times in the season, I'd watched three or four episode stretches in a row. It'd be ridiculous to take away from Tony's game there. He was playing with his hair on fire, but his head was in it the whole time. Yeah. And he was making moves. He was playing strategy the whole time. And when it didn't go his way or when things didn't work out, he was able to respond in the moment like Sarah was, like a police officer. He was able to assess the facts and stay on his feet and stay alive. And I think that ultimately, just because he didn't do so well this time, he did terribly this time around, I don't think that should – it hasn't changed the way I look at his game at all.
No, likewise, completely. And I guess let's do this now, actually, while we're on her. How about Sandra's 3.0? How is your impression of her change now that she has finally got a blemish on the record?
Yeah, I always had a better view of her than you did, but never
– Not hard. Version.
Yeah, yeah. But also not like – I also wasn't all in. Like, I wasn't to the level that other people were. I thought that Paul Asleson did a great podcast with Rob Cesternino at the beginning of the season as part of the preview series, where Paul really spelled out all of the various good things about Sandra's game.
I totally agree. For the record, he was fantastic, and it was a great podcast.
Yeah, and maybe I was looking at Sandra the wrong way. I'm willing to admit, like, maybe I was lensing her incorrectly, because that made me reassess a lot of what I thought. And so maybe I was more receptive to noticing the good things about her game this time around. But I thought she was great. I thought it was a little bit inevitable that she would go. Even still, I thought she lasted a lot longer than people thought. She was able to orchestrate some stuff. I think she was able to display how a chaotic move like burning socks or burning a hat or hiding a machete can actually work well, instead of just making people angry, a specifically targeted move like she did with Michaela and with JT. Was something that really was able to serve her well and to serve her agenda. And I think probably the most masterful part of that is that Michaela wasn't mad at Sarah for bringing all that heat onto Michaela. Like, she was just like, yep, we're on the same team about this. So I thought Sandra did a really, really, really phenomenal job. I think out of a pre-merge in a season like this, I love that her success was such a big part of that story, made it more exciting for me. I know you're pretty well on the record about this, but I'm actually curious overall, was there anyone in this season who came off looking worse to you, reputation-wise or skill-wise, than you had thought about them coming into this season, or did everyone improve?
That is an interesting question. Let me roll through. No, I frankly feel like the worst was, yeah, that was about what I expected.
Right.
Like for
Tony.
People like Ty Sierra. Or like Troy Zan or Haley or whatever.
Right.
Yeah, no, yeah. I'm totally with that. And for Sandra in particular, like I was someone, I don't feel like I say this enough, and when I do, it goes unheard, but like I've always loved Sandra as a character and just not been a big fan of her like strategy and her general approach and the way she thinks about the game. This season, I grew to love her even more as a character and was thrilled to finally see her out there, like really, from my money, like taking her fate into her own hands for like the first time. I'm ecstatic at what I got from Sandra this season and impressed beyond belief that she survived like 4 or 5 votes. That's incredible.
Yeah, and that's certainly better than what expected, not about what expected, right? Like that, she did a really good job. And even when Tony goes, like when in that first episode, when we leave that with Tony getting the boot, my thought is Sandra has literally nothing now. Like her best game involved using him as a shield, and now he's gone. Like this is where anybody but me is going to burn her, because she should have put that aside and kept this target around. Didn't seem like it burned her. Like who knows what happens if Tony stays in the game there. But I thought that was fascinating, because even I thought, like, okay, Sandra, I like you, and I think that there's a lot to your game, and I'm coming in here with this open mind, and yet I thought this is it. You've just torpedoed your only shot. And in reality, like, it didn't seem to be the thing that caused her a problem at all. I just think it's fascinating that we have a season called Survivor Game Changers, and we heard from people like Sierra Dawn Thomas and others who were cognizant of the fact that, were they even game changers? Like, why were they on the season? And they maybe felt like they had to live up to the title or whatever. But I think one of the key people we would have put in this topic after Sierra and Haley and others, in terms of they're a game changer, what are they doing here, won the season, Colin.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think we put it in terms of Sarah's there because Tony's back.
Yeah, it certainly seemed that way. And I think there's a little more to it. Like, clearly they liked her and they wanted to use her again. And she was a strategist. She was thinking. Her boot episode plays very poorly for her, but it's her boot episode. Of course it's going to play poorly for her. They had to show David Bloomberg why Sarah lost Survivor. Like, they needed to put that content in there to make it clear why Cass flipped. And that content wasn't good for Sarah, and it made her look bad. So I think we went into this season with a bad perception. And I read Josh's pregame interviews, and he did that great thing, of course, where he's asking all the other players what they think of the players in question. And everybody was saying, Sarah, oh boy, like she's not looking good. I make eye contact with her pregame and she's all over the place. And I thought, Colin, I'll say it, I thought Sarah was going to be the first boot of this season.
Yeah.
Like, I really thought that was going to, because I thought her problem in Cagayan was people-based. She rubbed people the wrong way. She was a police officer, and she behaved like the negative stereotype where she was like, it's my way or the highway, and I don't like it when people treat me that way. And she was being like abrasive and trying to control things. And I just thought, well, if she's coming into the pregame not really aligned with these people, not somebody that they're saying favorable things about pregame, and she gets out there and tries to behave the way she did in the past, she's done. And here she does. She goes and wins it. So she wasn't a game changer. She won the game changer season. I certainly think it was a game changing season. So she's a game changer now. And all the props to her. Like I said, in thinking about her, I just thought there's not a single person who I have a worse view of after this season than I did before the season. And I think that's probably pretty rare for a returning player season.
Well, I may have found one, Antonio. And I hate to say it, Juicy Thick, our boy JT. Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, sorry. I really try not to deduct any points based on things that happen in return shots, particularly for former winners, like who have just the craziest targets on their back. I've always basically been a JT apologist about how Heroes versus Villains went down. But this season, it really felt to me like I can't help but dock at least some points from JT.
Yeah, and I think your mileage may vary on that after, in terms of, you said you've been an apologist. In terms of how people viewed him after Heroes versus Villains, they might have not expected him to do very well in this season, and they might have had their expectations fully validated. But I'm more with you in that camp, and I think you're right to point out Juicy Thick is probably the player who, unfortunately, when you talk about data points and sample size, it's starting to look more and more like this is the truth about JT, and that JT, who, by the way, many people coming out of Token Sheens would say, well, there's Kim Spradlin's, like some of her top competition in terms of the same skill sets, in terms of the things that were done, maybe even won against better competition. Like, JT is a cautionary tale for, I think, Spradlinism in terms of the,
I like
the,
it.
Yeah, the religion that we're creating.
Yeah.
Like she's his less he's her less smart brother. Like he's the person that we can look at and say very similar data points. And actually, JT's Token Chain's cast obviously I think better than the One World cast. And yet here we are.
So he's the Millerites at the start of the season that we're supposed to be worried about.
Yes, exactly. Like he's a cautionary tale.
Right.
Like we have to be very careful. We have to look at the data points we've got from JT and recognize that it could go south for anybody. And you're right. I was the same as you after Heroes versus Villains. I thought Guy had to take a swing. Like he took a swing. If it had worked, it would have been great. It would have changed the whole game. He took a swing and it was to us historically terrible. But what did he know about Russell? He didn't know. He should have known, but he didn't know. And so we get what we get. And unfortunately this season, nothing really good from JT came out of this season. Unfortunately, didn't even get a question at the finale. Colin.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of people didn't get questions. How many people didn't get questions at the finale? I'm sure the stats out there somewhere.
It's probably 5 or 6, 2 ex-winners. Cause Tony didn't get one either. But for JT and Tony not to get a question at this finale, if you said that preseason, it's like, well, things must have gone really south for these guys, and it certainly did in JT's case.
People need to know where to buy Jeff Varner's book. Come on.
Yeah, what's that called again? Is that called No Shame? I think that's called
something like that. I'm gonna need that book, by the way, after spending the last calendar year calling Ken and Brad wins.
Yeah, well, listen, I appreciate that you have little shame in that regard because I needed that throughout the season. Sarah was never my favorite player in this season, never. And I don't know that – I think most people could probably say that on the season where you've got fan favorites like Sari and like Aubrey and like Ty. But she was never my favorite. So I was always looking for a new savior, and I was always trying to put a lot of hope in your words that it would end up differently. And I can't believe I was putting stock in Brad Culpepper. although – He's an interesting cat. What's going on with Brad Culpepper's disappearing mustache, Colin?
Yeah, what is going on with that? So did he have like a bathroom ready to go? And this was like it seems like this had to be deliberate to shave, to go there with the, it's not a Tom Selleck mustache, but it's that bold and obvious of a mustache. And then go out back onto the red carpet sans mustache. It seems like the only thing people would really notice about him at the reunion.
I assumed he just he'd lost some kind of crazy side bet with you or Dom.
Yeah.
And the stakes were that he had to wear a bet. He had to wear a mustache to the finale. Like, I just figured that it has to be a lost bet, right? Like, that has to be it.
It's got to be something along those lines. I don't know what it is, but it was definitely weird. Let's get into a couple of the other just kind of notes from the reunion. What did you, I guess, make of how it all went down between Zeke and Varner? I think that was the most notable thing for me, at least, was that kind of conversation, as particularly the Josh Wigler shout out, very famous Josh Wigler, your partner in crime over on the Leftovers podcast. How did you think they handled that?
He doesn't belong to us anymore. He belongs to the world. I thought that, it was always going to have to come up again. It was not something you can put to bed and not address on the finale. I don't know why they went back to Varner for the book plug. I thought it was fine for Zeke to have a moment to say why it mattered to him, what was important to him. A lot of the audience that was in the audience, in terms of the TV audience, probably didn't necessarily tune into everything that was going on with the Hollywood Reporter and Zeke posting these things and his exit interviews and everything that Zeke was doing in the wake of all of that. So a lot of people probably weren't tuned into the aftermath of it, and this is probably the first update they've gotten. So I appreciate that they went to Zeke, and I appreciate that they went to Jeff. Jeff's a human being. Jeff made a huge mistake. Whatever led him to make that mistake, his drawbacks, his failings, are human drawbacks and failings, and they're inextricably linked with his experience. So I think to deny him the opportunity to speak his side of it is one thing. I just don't – I cannot fathom why they went back to him for the book plug. Like, you can't take that time to go say, hey – Tony, like, did you feel like you ever had any shot? Like, what was it like? What's it like to see Sarah win? Like, what's it like for you to see somebody on your season? What do you have to say? You can't go back to Tony and say that. Look, it's hard. I'm not criticizing. I don't want to be too critical. It's a freaking live television show. You know a ton, Colin, about live TV. You know that things can go askew very quickly.
Very
you
know fast.
Yeah, and you know the difficulty of pulling your way out of those holes. So I understand that. I'm not going to say that Survivor should be perfect. These reunion shows I thought, generally speaking, the reunion show was good, especially considering what we've had in the past, where we don't get to a lot of the cast. I think the fact that we got to as many as we could, I think it's fine. They didn't spend a ton of time hyping another season. They didn't spend a ton of time with Sia or a random person in the audience. So I thought, generally speaking, it was good. Don't know why they went back to Jeff Varner. What do you think?
Yeah. Take on the Aubrey and Cochran thing. Was that too cheesy for you?
Yes, a little bit. I guess they feel like they've got people in the audience who want that. I don't know how much they test these things, or Jeff is going by purely the man on the street, people stopping him. But are people really stopping Jeff Probst and saying, hey, you think Aubrey and Cochran could be a couple? Or is that Jeff Probst, like, busting Cochran's balls? Like, is he putting his friend on blast and using reunion showtime to just serve a personal goal there? What's the goal in asking that question?
I think that is 100% it. It's, we want to cut to Cochran. Everyone in America loves Cochran.
Yeah, and that's Jeff's view. It's probably validated by a lot of the feedback that Jeff gets from the people that Jeff talks to about Survivor. I'm not saying I don't love Cochran. I loved it when Cochran was the reward. I'm laughing just thinking about it. Like, is that Cochran? Like, what is that? This is your reward? I wish we had seen Cochran out there with Ozzy or with someone like that. That would have been fantastic. But I like the idea that Cochran was a little bit of a Debbie whisperer, and she did really seem to make a 180 after he disappeared from, like, into the mist. Like, just he appeared and then he was gone. Like, I love that. So, yeah, you're right. It's probably just to get Cochran on TV. It's a shame. We should have Aubrey passing the Bechdel test, not failing it, Colin.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and as usual, Cochran's just kind of, like, grinning awkwardly into the camera, and I swear, Aubrey gave, like, the Sophie watching Jack and Jill face into the camera when they were setting up the segment.
Yes. Yeah, I watched it again because I saw a lot of comments about that, and I didn't really notice it real time. When I watched it again, I was dying. I was like, oh, poor Aubrey. That is so uncomfortable.
By the way, Aubrey has a long-term boyfriend who is very cool.
Yeah, well, that's too bad for the rest of us, I guess. But too bad for Cochran.
No shade on Cochran. I'm sure Cochran, a very cool guy himself.
Yeah.
Even though he'd probably spend like 15 minutes talking me out of that being true if he was on this podcast right now.
Are you sure? That's not too much? Like, I'm not uncool? Like, are you sure? Like, that is possible. Yeah, too bad for the rest of us that Cochran is probably taken as well. Although, I think Cochran tells tales of never dating and never talking to anybody. So, there might be hope for the rest of us yet.
Okay. Well, another note from this reunion, we officially find out what the tiebreaker is going to be. And thankfully, it's the tiebreaker that Dom and I have always at least assumed it would be, which is the third place juror voting. What do you think about that?
Great. That's what it needs to be. And I think that knowing that it's out there, I think that changes the way people can play the game. I think that knowing that it's out there causes the need, at least creates the need, whether or not they'll act on it, creates a need for both of the other finalists or for all three of the finalists to have better, closer relationships. And I guess that my concern would be that, do you lock in a three that is like we did in this episode, where as soon as they go on that reward, they exchange jewelry and they lock their finale alliance in, and that's it. And there's nothing that anybody could have done to penetrate that alliance at that point. And we're all wasting our breath. And we don't see that on TV because that's not compelling television. But once those three locked that in, it was set. Like, it was totally set, and they weren't going to cut anybody else. And that was that. And I think that's the risk you run, is once you incentivize making it so that it's vital for everyone within the final three to have a close relationship with one another, you do incentivize them to be tighter, but you also incentivize the possibility that the final three will start turning on each other perhaps a little earlier. Maybe Brad's going to say to Troy, like, hey, Troy, if for whatever reason it's a tie, you'll vote for me and not Sarah, right? Because she shouldn't – and he starts talking down to Sarah. And maybe that causes Troy to go to Sarah and be like, you don't believe what Brad's saying about you. And so maybe there is turmoil there. But that's the only downside I can see, is that it could potentially cause – those three to be a lot closer and a lot more linked together, because there's a lot more incentive to have the goat that's there, have the third person that's there, be the third person that will cast the vote for you. And I think so hopefully that would lead to more intrigue in the game and not less.
I've always been a big proponent of make it a final two and tell them ahead of time, this is a final two, because it's so much harder for a pair to, like, run the game and get to the end together than a group of three where any third part, like the example we tend to use when we make our arguments for why Final Twos are is just like in game theory terms, I would say far superior to Final Threes, is every single person on One World convinced themselves that, of course, Kim wants to go with Chelsea, but she's also going with me too. So that's fine. I can link up with the two of them. Whereas if people know that's a Final Two, that's completely off the table. Where do you stand on that? The issue of Final Two versus Final Three? Is it time to switch back?
It's difficult because I can understand why they went to three, right? And correct me if I'm wrong about this, but they go to three because the idea is that some of those final three people, Rob Cesternino being a great example, right? Like some of the final three people are people they would have preferred to see in a final tribal. That you can't have a person who's been great all season and clearly the best person who's going to win get booted at three, and then you have two people who are less liked or who the audience or who the editors are going to have a more difficult job selling as one of them being a great winner. So I understand what they're trying to correct with that final three. But haven't we seen a ton of zero vote third finalists?
Yeah. Oh, we certainly have. It's far more. I think the only time that all three have gotten votes were China and Worlds Apart.
Right. And so are you bringing people into this scenario where and Worlds Apart, like there at least once that's been because of bitterness, right? Like, so I think, right? Like, so, oh, I really am voting for this other person because I don't want that person to get the money, like to get the second place.
Yeah. Philippines also, by the way, I'm now realizing.
Yeah. And then that's when I've seen that really come up most. But I think, generally speaking, I prefer a final two. I don't like the idea that the great players are going to get killed at three, but I think that the great players probably need to learn to adapt to that a little better. I haven't thought that through, but there's probably a better way to ensure that it doesn't happen at three where you get the axe if you're the best player left, and I don't know if that's to make a really solid two in terms of that three or not, but I agree. I would rather have a final two, generally speaking. I think that there is a lot more drama in that final two choice. It does elevate a player like Tony, right? They have put someone like Wu in a position where they give him the old Tom Westman Ian treatment, where they mind erase him and they put him in a position where they feel like they have to do the thing that's wrong for them to do. So I like the ability for a gamer to have that opportunity to make that move. It doesn't always work, obviously. So the downside is you get two duds. I don't think Cass winning Kageyan would have been a true dud. Like, I think that would have been okay.
How would that have happened? We would have beaten her unanimously.
Fair point. So, yeah, I guess that there isn't – I was trying to think of the worst scenario, and I guess the worst scenario is your Survivor winner is Wu. So yeah, I don't know. I generally prefer a final two, and I know you and Dom do. So yeah. My concern or my thinking is – in the Troy Zan really, really exposes this or makes it clear is most of the time you're having a third person in the finals. It's just a pure goat. And you're getting goats dragged along to the end. And I'm not sure that that's what we want out of Survivor ultimately. And I think that means a person like Suri or Aubrey is always going to be just dead at 6 and 5. That's part of the game. I don't think it's broken per se. I just would prefer to see a final two, I think. And I think the no vote finalist in final three doesn't really help it out at all. I don't find that more palatable than the idea that a lesser winner could win a season.
Right. You've got people thinking, I need to drag goats because I have to beat two people, not just one in the finals. Right. I need someone I can beat.
Right.
And I hate that people know. And like, that's why I am adamant that if they do go back to a final two, it is paramount that Jeff Probst tell them on day one, this is a final two. It makes the game so much more complicated if people know they are playing down to two spots.
How do you feel generally? Because I agree with that. But how do you feel generally about advantages being known? Like, so do you feel like Jeff should lay bare the rules of the game and every aspect like that beforehand? Like, okay, so there's going to be a legacy advantage in play. There's going to be a vote steal advantage in play. And for the first time ever, there's going to be a informed voter advantage in play. Like, do you think it's best to spell all that out the way they did with the tiebreaker rule in this season before the season, no matter what the advantage is?
I wouldn't say no matter what the advantage is. I think it can definitely be case by case what you tell people when, like if it's public or not. In the case of the legacy advantage, it just seems so obvious almost to tell them about it. Otherwise, it seems like far more often than not, like we saw with Ken, is going to be the standard thing where no one knew about it and it makes no difference for the vote and it was never really a storyline. Now, granted, we have the very next season, Sarah, the legacy advantage, from what I can tell, basically like bails her out there. but I would be certainly an advocate for letting people know the legacy advantages in play, the same way that Jeff eventually started saying hidden immunity idols are in play at the beginning of every season. And it really would honestly for me be just be case by case for whatever the rest of the advantages are. Like, I have no problem with the reward stealer being a secret. I think that one's fine to keep secret.
Yeah, I guess it just does depend on what the advantage is. And you're right. The reward stealer, does it really matter if you know that that's in play or not? I just think that it's generally speaking, when I'm playing a game, I like to know what the rules of the game are while I'm playing. Yeah. And I think Survivor has always been a game where there could be something in play that isn't that case and that isn't going to happen. And I think that once you know an advantage like that can be in play, you change the way you play. So there are things like that, but the reward steal is clearly not one of those things. And so I think whoever's designing the games does a very good job of conceptualizing new things to be included and finding ways to work things in, or understanding what ideas from the audience, like hiding idols at challenges, are great ideas, and ones which maybe need a little bit of help and don't need to get all the way through, like the informed voter advantage. They maybe don't need to be put right into the game. So I think they do a great job, and I'm sure that that's how what they keep in mind. But I think generally speaking, the players should know, because if they're going to improve the casting, which they've done, and they're going to have players who are capable of being smart and making decisions, and they're not just casting pure game bots or pure mactors, I think that you can tell the players more about the game, and I think it's only going to lead to more compelling television if you do.
Yeah, I think what may have happened is, like what happened to Steven, they saw, oh, he gets this advantage, but then when everyone knows he has this advantage and then he tells people it's the vote stealer, that puts a huge target on him, and I think they overcorrected and wanted it to all be super low-key so that it could maximize blindsides for people.
Yeah, I think you're probably right, and classic returning player season overcorrection.
Yeah, yeah. Antonio, what was your thoughts just on Game Changers as a season? Where is this ranking? Do you do season rankings? Is this going to be high for you?
It wouldn't be very high for me, unfortunately. There's some memorable stuff that goes on, unquestionably, for the good and the bad. And I think that it's not memorable to see a player like Malcolm go out, but I liked that. I was actually happy with that. We were sitting very close to each other in the same room when that happened, and we saw the reactions in that room. I was very quietly at the side of the table applauding to myself, because I appreciated that there was some liveliness there, and I didn't like the inevitability. Everyone had picked Malcolm as their winner pick, so I liked seeing the upheaval. But look what we get. We get a winner that was no one's winner pick, or that was a very few people's winner pick. I think Renee Herrera had picked her. I don't know to what degree people might have been spoiled if they picked Sarah Lucina, but she was not a very popular winner pick, and yet she went out and won the season. And were people more satisfied with that or less? I think for me, anytime you have a season full of players that I like, which this one had, and you have players that I like making moves and playing the game hard, which certainly they were doing throughout, I think it's already above probably 10 or 15 Survivor seasons, right? Like, there are these seasons that generally speaking are still fun. They're still like compelling TV, and we still like to talk about them, but they're just duds. Like, they're just not nearly on the same level, and that mostly has to do with the casting.
Yeah.
And I think the casting for this one was very strong. My thought is what you've echoed and a lot of people have said. Can they ever do a returning player season again where the level of competition is not equal, where you've got half the cast who are clearly game changers and the other half who are clearly not game changers? Can you really do that? Should we have returning player seasons that are more equal in terms of the skill level?
I think completely. I think one of my biggest takeaways from this season, and this was something that a lot of people picked up on as we were watching the early people get voted out, is we need to, as far as I'm concerned, be saving these like stud returnees to play against each other, because it seems to me like if we keep having these top heavy casts where we have maybe six or seven people that have these giant like Hall of Fame reputations, for some of them have played 100 days already, some of them, among a lot of people, like the people, frankly, that we saw, with the exceptions of like Suri and Aubrey, everyone else who was there in the end game, it seems like that is going to be the natural byproduct, is almost all of the true heavy hitters get taken out very early, and maybe one or two of them will sneak through to like the final seven.
Is it then, does it boomerang back though? Like, so if we ran this game up again with the same cast, knowing everyone had known what had happened on their previous season, don't people say, like, you have to get out some of these quiet ones first, because it's the quiet ones who are going to run this game. You saw what happened last time. And we saw the beginnings of this. Aubrey has said, like, the key to her game was playing with the big targets, because she knew she was a big target. So she had the right read in many respects. Like, she needed to go out there and surround herself with like people, because she recognized that some of the cast would have been like her and some was not. So I'll go with the ones who are like me so that we can form an alliance and get rid of the ones that aren't. So isn't it possible that there's a swing back where people say, yeah, there's a lot of targets on these seasons, but we always get taken out. You got to take out the person who is not the big target, but who is really good strategically and really good socially and is not otherwise. I just feel like there could be a pendulum swing back in the other direction. I mean, were people really thinking that that Ciara Easton was going to win this season of Survivor? Was she the first boot because of that?
Maybe not. I think she was the first boot just because she was out there probably throwing out the most people's names. Like, if you're getting voted out on a tribe that has both Tony and Sandra on it, like we said at the time, you've done something wrong. There is no way that you haven't brought that upon yourself.
Yeah, I just feel like if you're evaluating the game when you set foot on that beach, and you know as a returning player that some of these players are we're going to kill each other. We're going to eat each other, and we're going to take each other out of the game, and then whoever's left is going to be who wins this game. Isn't it an easier, more compelling case to make to people and say, listen, we got to get rid of the quiet ones. We got to get rid of these ones who were not going to, because those are the ones who are going to be there. They're going to make the jury because we all killed each other. That's the part I'm not sure about, is that I would normally say we got to save these people, but I feel like there's a possibility that the game, as it always does, will adapt and evolve such that the people will become bigger targets for not being big targets. Like, that alone will put the target on their back. And I think that's the difficult thing, that I'm not sure that we'll ever strike that balance on Survivor. But I feel like this problem would iron itself out as more and more people have that game knowledge, and as we continue to build the data. I think people would adapt and evolve to the Sarah Lucina win. And people would say, the people like Sarah Lucina, those are the ones that have to go first, not the people like Tony, who we can always get out. People are always going to want to get rid of him because he's always going to be seen as a threat. This person who we don't see as a threat, let's get them out because we're never going to see him as a threat. We're never going to get him out if we don't. I think that's a huge part of it.
Do you think Jeremy may have swung the pendulum the other way and now it swung back? Like, people saw Jeremy win Second Chance and thought, oh, he was a big threat we should have seen coming? Because, like, I don't think he was viewed as a big strategic threat entering that season, much like Sarah. Like, I don't think we've ever had someone win Survivor on their return shot, and I'm including Sandra in this list, who was viewed as a big threat at even pre-merge in those seasons. Like, if we run through Amber, Sandra, Jeremy, and now Sarah, and then I would also include Cochran, Tyson, and Parvati winning as like on these half and half seasons, the common theme really jumps off the page that these are not people who were taken seriously as players entering those seasons.
Yeah, you're right. And so I think that the more that we have conversations like this, the more people talk like this, the more players start to talk like this, the more you could see the game adapt and evolve. And I do think that played a part potentially with Jeremy, because you're right, my read is the same as yours, that he wasn't seen as a great threat, and that's why he was able to last as long as he did. You know who else wasn't seen as a huge threat? Kelly Wentworth. Like, sometimes you bring these players back into the game. Ciara Dawn Thomas is sitting in the same spot she's sitting, and maybe that doesn't improve, maybe it does, but generally speaking, I think there's a reason to believe, if you're coming back to a season like this and you're a Sandra or you're a Ciara and you're with a group of other people like that, there's reason for those people to say, listen, we can always pick each other off and it will always be easy targets for anybody. So let's get out the people that won't always be that way and are going to end up walking away with this thing. Then we can play our game. I feel like there is incentive for these players to do that if we do have more mixed seasons. I think it's inevitable we're going to have mixed seasons for various reasons. And look, I think that Survivor did a great job. I would be fine with them bringing in, they would never call it this, but if we did a pre-merge season of Survivor, first of all, I'd be all on board with that. Pre-merge returning players only. People like Bryce Isaiah, people like Kelly Wentworth, not now, but could have been brought back at that point. I would trust them to find the best pre-merge tribes they possibly could, and I would be pretty sure we'd still get a good winner out of that season. So I trust them in just about everybody they bring back, and generally speaking, that has been proven to be true with Sarah winning. Like, none of us would have brought Sarah back. Sarah won. I know that's results oriented thinking, but they did the right thing bringing her back. But she in part won because all these targets took each other out. And I think if they had taken a deep breath, taken a step back, they would have been able to process. Brad doesn't win 5 immunities in a row if those big targets don't all go. And that's the kind of thing you have to be cognizant of as well. So there are things pulling you in a different direction.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely would love for that to be the case. And I think in a world where the field continues to evolve, and I think this jury, this the way that this played out was like a very positive sign for me in seeing people actively want to vote for Sarah. I feel like if that continues, if that kind of trend towards people thinking about the game and thinking about like jury votes in those terms continues, I would definitely have a ton of faith in people to start recognizing, oh, it's actually the Haley Fords we should be taking out early because she could just float on through. If we don't take her out very soon, no one's going to want to take her out later. I just really still wonder if we are even close to getting half of a cast thinking that way.
Yeah, maybe not. And it does matter that you have to build that pool, right? So you have to build a data pool of players who are being selected and cast with the mindset that they're currently using. And I think that's another part of it is I think you've got different casting philosophies in play throughout the evolution of the show. And I think that can change the pool of players who are there. It can change the seasons, which changes the viewpoints, and then they evolve. It's fascinating. Listen, Cochran wrote this paper that he wrote, whatever. Like, you could write, in the future, you'll be able to write lots about the way that Survivor has evolved as a game and the way players play the game of Survivor evolving as a result of so many of these different factors. And so I do think that it will take time to get to that position. And I would prefer to see, of course, if we do like a season 40 heroes versus villains, or we do a winners only season or whatever, I would prefer to see that be a very high level of competition across the board. And that I just prefer that from a TV standpoint, the more talented players you can get. I think that's why a lot of people like Kagiyan. There are a lot of people out there playing the game. In that Sarah Boot episode, people are saying, like, I've seen Trish. I've been with Trish. She doesn't do any strategizing. And it's Trish who is doing the strategizing that sends Sarah home. So I think that's fascinating that that even the players on some of these seasons that people are writing off in the context of the season do well. And I think, generally speaking, the better cast you have in terms of game players, the better off you're going to be. So I would prefer to see those returning player seasons going forward. But if we do votes and we do things like that, we're never going to guarantee that.
Oh, no, absolutely not. But I would say, just as a closing note for me, like, Survivor Game Changers has left me very optimistic about the future of Survivor. Are you on board with that?
Yeah. I mean, I like that they're willing to do new things. I think it's the confidence of a show that, as I said, has settled into a position where they know what their place is on the network. They're comfortable with it. I'm sure that there are people at the show who want more numbers, but I'm sure there are people at the show who are looking at, okay, we're going to settle into locations like Fiji. We're going to settle into this mode where we're doing this. I feel like it produces a show that I can't wait to watch every week. And that is still the case after Survivor Game Changers. I think there's a lot of good to be said about the fact that a person that almost everyone had written off, myself included, before the season, won the season and didn't do it in a passive fashion.
Yeah.
She won it by playing her ass off. And that's awesome. That's really encouraging to me because I would have not loved the season if a player who did nothing all season, Troyzan as the future Judd, comes out and just sort of as a good person and as a nice guy who likes the game, but from what we saw on TV, didn't do much, stumbles his way into a win. I vastly prefer, and I like Troy more than Sarah, but I vastly prefer seeing Sarah win. And that makes me feel better about the way Survivor will be going forward. These changes, these challenges, I think that's fine.
Yeah, and as much as I would much rather be giving the money to charity than to fucking Dom for winning our auction draft, I think if we had it come in that, like, Brad recognized that Ty needed to be there in the final three with him for him to win, and we have a Brad, Troyzan, Ty final three, I do not know how excited I would be about this season, even though I imagine he would have just, that hero edit would have lasted one episode longer, and we'd be talking about probably what a good game Brad Culpepper played. I do not know if that would be the best message for the season.
You're 100% correct. Whether or not, yeah, you don't know. Like, I know, and you're right. Like, that wouldn't have been the best message for the season. It's encouraging to see that a person played the game, and they played it in a way that has cost previous All-Stars winners. and it didn't cost them. They were rewarded for it. And they weren't rewarded because they took two goats. One of the people they took with them played a very good game, got multiple votes at Final Tribal, and was seen as a threat throughout. So I do think that it's very encouraging that the winner won, and that Sarah won, by playing a very difficult and high-level, high-strung, flipping, going from vote to vote kind of game. That's encouraging for me going forward, because I think that pagongings are less likely to happen if people feel like they have this latitude to act and to behave the way Sarah behaved in the season and still win. And so that, more than anything, is the best takeaway from this for me, is that a winner who played actively throughout and really was a person who was not making friends in that jury did still make friends in the jury with her gameplay. And that rewarded her at the end of the day, even as they were laughing at her, Colin. They were laughing at her when she said, like, oh, I swear it was real. Ty was like, I guess I thought that this was all real, that we were all on the same page. And Sarah, and everyone is laughing at Ty when he says this about Sarah, and she still won. That's pretty encouraging for me.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely with that. Antonio, Survivor 35, we have Heroes versus Healers versus Hustlers. Great season title or the greatest season title?
You put me in a very difficult position with the form of that question, Colin.
I came up with that question format myself. No one's ever used that.
My biggest issue is, how are healers not heroes? Are we not saying that our healers are not heroes now? Like, if you introduced me to a healer, I'd say, thank you for all the healing that you've done. It's very heroic of you.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
That's the part I struggle with. I can understand where you're going to juxtapose hustlers and heroes, or even maybe hustlers and healers, but I don't understand how healers and heroes are juxtaposed. The versus part is the part that bothers me, Colin. Look, Survivor Millennials versus Gen X has made it abundantly clear that you could call the season whatever you want to call it. If you have good cast and you have a good season, it doesn't really matter what your format is. But I just think the versus part, what are they going to get out of this? Like, there isn't as much mileage. I have an open mind, because Survivor usually more often than not does well. But I just don't understand. How about you? Where are you on this?
I mean, it's an obviously dumb title, but I think Rob made a good point, which is, what does it matter? It's sort of what you're saying, but like the way he put it is, like, you could have the best or the worst title ever, and is it going to swing the viewership by 1,000? It really doesn't matter. And actually, Antonio, I believe I'm right in saying that you are someone who's been an advocate, and I'm on board with this, for just call it Survivor 35, Survivor 36, like the Super Bowl going forward.
Yeah, I'm never going to win that battle, because they do like the hook, the marketing, and I get it. I'm with Rob in that. Maybe I'm with Rob because Rob is our master. Like, Rob he's the content guy. Like, he's the guy who's providing a lot of the voices about Survivor, and that's why we all are in groupthink about Kim Spradlin, but that's another matter entirely. Thank you for the bell. Why does it matter? It doesn't matter. Like, it just doesn't matter, and to the extent they try to make it matter, that's the part I struggle with. That said, I liked Heroes versus Villains as a binary concept. I like that the villains, some of them, were not happy being called a villain, and some of the heroes weren't heroic. And so I like the opportunity of Heroes and Hustlers. I'm okay with that, where you've got these seemingly altruistic people who put themselves behind everything and who put God or country or whatever ahead of things. But I don't like it that you've got the healers in the middle of this. It just doesn't track with me. And I really hope that no one on the healers tribe is like, why am I not a hero? Like, I should be a hero. I'm a healer. I'm a hero. I just, that's the part where it's like, do I need that on my TV? I don't need that.
Yeah. The good news is, I would imagine we're not going to be in these tribes for too long. What's the line? Like, episode 3 for the first swap?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. And then you get the heroes and the healers together, and they're like, oh, we're so alike. And maybe the hustlers are not alike. Could there be an overabundance of a certain type because the heroes and the healers are too similar?
I mean, there could be an overabundance of people with big heads about them, which I think is actually good for Survivor.
Yeah, for sure, especially with some hustlers in the mix, right? Because they can play one off the other. They can take that out of them. Like, there is some ability to pit that against the, you know, one group against two in that respect. And just because somebody's a healer by Survivor's definition doesn't mean they're a heroic healer. I mean, they're featuring a surgeon here, right, as one of the six people that's featured. And listen, not every doctor is heroic. Not every doctor is somebody who you're like, wow, what an altruistic, kind, generous individual. Lots of doctors are chumps. So I think it's a, it's fascinating to say just because somebody's a healer doesn't mean they should think of themselves in a good way. You're right. We could get some big headitis, and that could be great.
Yeah, I assume they're putting all the lawyers on the Heroes tribe this time, Antonio.
Let's hope not. Listen, is Jimmy McGill from Better Call Saul, if he's anything, he's a hustler, right?
Yeah. No, I'd imagine that's where they would be. What else is a hustler?
Yeah, well, a bellhop, apparently.
Yeah, hey, you got to literally hustle.
I think Boston Rod, I think he was a hustler. I think he would tell you he was a hustler.
Sure.
I think that's a recent Survivor character who is hustling in his way there. So, yeah, who knows?
But occupationally, it seems like lawyers would probably stand out, or like athletes maybe.
Sales, because it's a hustle, like you're always selling somebody on something. Maybe a three-card Monty dealer? Is that possible?
I think that's probably pretty likely. That would be great. I mean, they used to get people with these obscure professions. I don't know what happened to that.
Yeah, we had like what was – I'm trying to think of who the Undertaker was in the previous season.
Dara,
that's right. Dara, yeah. So we've had Undertakers and we've had some whacked out professions for sure.
Yeah, I love like Magician's Assistant was one of my favorites. It was one of the girls from Guatemala was a Magician's Assistant.
Yeah, was she the legs or the head? I don't think we ever figured that out.
Yeah, unclear. I'm not quite sure.
But yeah, so I don't know. Listen, I think that we lionize and we have on this particular podcast, but other podcasts, we lionize Kagiyan and we call it Kagiyan without really acknowledging that was a brains, brawn, and beauty season, right? And that the tribe names did really play in a little bit, especially with the Brains tribe, to what was going on in that season, that the Brains tribe occupied this space where they were just so sure they were the Brains tribe. And how can we not work this out? And it started with David Sampson, and your boy Garrett was on the spot with that. And it just continued to perpetuate throughout. So I like it when you give somebody a tribe name that impacts how they're lensing the game, much the way the Game Changers name impacted the way all of these people did. I'm just not sure we're going to get a ton of mileage out of Heroes, Hustlers, and Healers. But my mind's open to it. They haven't really screwed this up with the theme. Even the ones we've really spit on have been good. So whatever, let it be.
Yeah, you mentioned Bellhop Ryan that I know a lot of people are into. Did you like him or anyone else standing out to you from the couple of seconds we got to see of these people?
Not really. And I don't like Bellhop Ryan. No. Whatever. I'm sure he'll do well because why else is he getting featured there? But I don't like him. No, he looks like David Tennant, though. I think that's pretty cool. Even though I'm not a Doctor Who fan, that face looked recognizable to me. I'm looking forward to seeing him if he's a fan of the game, if he knows how Survivor is played, and he's a likable, charismatic guy. He's going to have an impact on the season, and I'm fine with that. But I didn't – no, after what, 10 seconds of the guy, I didn't like him. No.
Yeah, the only one – what is he, like a neurosurgeon or something that jumped out? Like that one seemed like the next David Sampson kind of early boot.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, not every doctor is like there. When we talked about the strengths of Cherie, like you have to balance a lot of egos. And it's the same way I'm here to tell you. It's the same way with us. It's the same way with lawyers. Like you are bringing a lot to the table when you bring that profession, when you're a person of letters like that or whatever. So it would not shock me if he came in with a Garrett or a David, or there's plenty of people that come in with that kind of ego. And so we could see that play out for sure.
Yeah. To tie it back into our winner now, Sarah, and I can't believe I didn't think to ask this earlier when you brought up Derek Levasseur, and also with all the talk of Tony, do we need to retire having cops and undercover cops on these shows? It is crazy, the success rate.
Yeah, well, listen, so you're telling me that cops are good at lying and being jerks? And yeah, that's a shocker to me, Colin. Like, it is part of the profession, right? But we could see the downside to that profession. I think we saw it, as I pointed out, with Sarah's first game, which is that people are used to being in charge, and they're used to being able to tell people what to do and have them do it. And they're used to being respected or being in charge, being the people that are controlling things. And I think that can be difficult to put aside. But I still think that there's no chance that Derek doesn't play the game he played without the skill set he built up in his profession. But look, you are who you are when you walk into this game, whether you're a lawyer, whether you're a teacher, whatever your skill set is. You aren't defined by your profession. We aren't that simple. And I never look at somebody and say, oh, so-and-so has 4 college degrees from Harvard, so they're a more wise person or a better person than a person who dropped out of high school. Like, I don't think of the world in those frames, because that's when you get ripped off. When you undersell somebody because they don't meet some standard or expectation that you've built in your brain, that's when that person has your wallet in about 2 minutes. So I think it's better to just evaluate anybody as potentially able to take your wallet is really, I guess, the point I'm making. No,
Sorry, go ahead.
No, go.
No, I was going to say, you can find out all of the ways to get those kind of people's wallets when you watch Better Call Saul.
Yeah, exactly, right? Like, yeah, there are plenty of people in the drug game, in the Breaking Bad universe, who I'm sure didn't graduate high school or college and who are way more wise and way sharper than the people who are these people of letters who are so stuck in their own egos and so caught up in their own mix that can bring them to the table. So I don't think police officers, generally speaking, do worse than, you know, the general public. I think that depending on the role that they've occupied as a police officer, I think it can serve them really well. But I think the same could be said for a guy like Adam Klein, who has to interact with people of all walks of life, who works at a homeless shelter or worked at a homeless shelter, but also was responsible not just with, like, it's not like he's just ladling soup out for people. He's probably helped raise money for that homeless shelter. He's probably working at volunteer events. He's probably talking to people from all walks of life, all backgrounds, all of that. You can't tell me that doesn't suit him well as a skill set, same as we talked about with Ceri. So does Sarah Lucina have a better skill set because she's learned how to lie and she's learned how to boss people around? Yeah, I'm sure that's true. But we saw it burn her in her first season. So I think it can serve – I think it can do you well and do you negatively.
Yeah. I wonder – I'd never thought about this before, but now that you bring up Adam and having just other things playing in external roles, not only his mom, but having the experience with, like, the homeless shelter and understanding, I think, much better than most people his age on Survivor, that what he's doing when he's out there is just a game and there's so much more going on in the world that he has to worry about. I really wonder if that kind of helped him keep like a healthy state of mind while he was out there. He wasn't just caught up in only thinking about the game. He understood what the game was.
Yeah, and that especially true with what was happening with his mom, for sure. And listen, there's a sweet spot on that, right? Because that can things that are happening outside the game, whether it's something happening with a family member or otherwise, what you bring to the game with you, your baggage, for good or worse, whether you have a bellhop or not, like your baggage that you bring into the game with you can serve you well or can serve you negatively. And I think that probably did serve Adam well to have perspective on life and as well, just like I said, have the 10,000 hour skills that he has, because he hasn't just his 10,000 hour skill involves communicating with people, listening to people, interacting with people. His play style was so direct, and you can't tell me that directness where he's like, now I don't want to vote with you. I'm going to have to vote you out if we come down to five. That served him well, probably because he's been very direct with people in his life in other ways, and he brought that with him into the game. So Sarah brought some negative stuff with being a police officer with her into the game the first time. I think she evened that out, ironed it out. She matured. It's been several years. She was much better her second time around. And I think it's fascinating that Ceri, in her exit press and throughout the game, has said she identifies with Michaela, and she looks at Michaela like, that was me. That was me. And you just wonder, like, what's Michaela going to be like in 10 years? She's a brilliant person, but she has these impulses that are problematic. Her mom recognizes them. Ceri recognizes them. We saw both of those women saying to Michaela, like, you got to keep this in check throughout the season. So when Michaela grows and when Michaela learns and she gets new skills, I think she's going to only be a better Survivor player. So I do think that it's just fascinating what you bring with you into the game does impact how you play, obviously. And certainly for certain police officers, it does serve them really well.
Yeah. Antonio, fantastic stuff. Anything else Survivor related that you wanted to get to?
No, I just, we talked about what I really wanted to talk about with you, because it's just your perspective on the game is so awesome, I think. And you and Dom do such a great job. I'm not sucking kneecaps. I really think that there's so much value in this podcast from this perspective and the issues I wanted to talk about, like the advantages, the final three. Do we tell what's out there versus what's not? And all of these things, the jury format. I think that there's a lot to be mined about how the game evolves and where we go with the future of the game, with what we saw in this season. And I can't wait to hear you and Dom talk about this for 3 hours. And if Dom is still listening to this podcast, Dom, I hope you're able to keep the gloating in check, because speaking of check, I think you're owed one. So that's the difficult part, is that Dom could really just – you talked him into so much this season, and you talked him into a lot of bad choices throughout, and you have done that before. that his I want to go back and listen to when he bought Sarah, what he said about his purchase at the time. How bullish was he on Sarah? Was he thinking that the stock was pointing up? And was he – do you remember if he thought this was a great investment?
I have not gone back and listened to that yet, although spoiler alert, I did plan on that being the intro to our season in review podcast, was putting the clip in of us auctioning off Sarah Lacina.
Okay, so I love anytime there's a season like this and there's an auction before it, I love going back after the season is over and listening to those auctions again and listening to what people's informed takes, because they are very informed takes on what they're doing when they're drafting and picking are. And it's just fascinating. It's fun when they're not informed too. I had a lot of fun listening to Dan and Jess and Mike on their amazing race draft, because we're coming up with the finale of that. Talk about the people they were so sure based on very little information had these things, because their takes were wild and all over the place. But I'm really looking forward to listening to that auction podcast again and what people said and what emerged to be true, because that's how we learned, right? We say, this is what we were thinking with the data we had at our hands at this point. Here's why we were wrong. Here are the things that tripped us up, so that the next time we make these calls, we can make better calls. I'm really looking better calls all.
Yeah.
I'm really looking forward to that.
We can make better calls all.
Right. that's fantastic. Yep. All right. I'm not going to do better than that.
Yeah, that's right. Antonio, you are on Twitter at AC Mazzaro. That is 2 Z's and 1 R. You can be found talking about The Leftovers twice a week and Better Call Saul once a week over on Post Show Recaps and postshowrecaps.com. Anything else that you would like to plug at this time?
No, those shows are ending, though. So I'd love to know what people think we should talk about next, because it's going to be a pretty boring summer for your boy over here.
The Grinder is what you should talk about next.
you and I have we could probably take our notes from Twitter conversations about The Grinder and read them out onto a podcast and have about a half a season.
Yeah, I just wanted before you got out of here, I wanted to get the official Antonio endorsement on both The Grinder and The Genius.
Yeah, oh, all in on The Genius. Like, I couldn't be more all in on The Genius, and I'm going to expand into Crime Scene and Society Game very, very soon here in the summer. But you, of course, were right all along about The Genius being great. I wish there were more shows like The Genius. If you have, for whatever reason, not watched The Genius, there are a million reasons why and very few reasons why not. So now is a great time. The summer is a great time. Do that. The Grinder, man, if you have Netflix and you don't want to watch it, just set your account to autoplay it so they think people are watching it, because I would love to see them make more. Tragically, the show ended after only one season. But if you're a fan of Community, because of the show's meta nature, or Scrubs or shows like that, which are meta and are aware they're TV shows and the people that are writing them are really smart and really sharp in terms of that, The Grinder will deliver for you in a way that many shows have not. Like, it is almost rarefied air, because there's a show within a show and there's all these great characters. The performances are great. The cast is loaded. Probably cost so much money to make because of how great the cast is, and that's probably why we didn't get a season 2 of The Grinder. But if you like legal shows, sitcoms, Rob Lowe, meta shows, I don't know why you're not watching it already.
Yeah. Netflix can afford a season 2. Come on.
Netflix can they're throwing money at literally everything, Colin. They can afford a season 2. I hope that's why. That is how they make their shows. They made House of Cards because they knew people were watching political shows on Netflix. They knew what people really like to watch, and they were like, we should get in this game. Like, they make new seasons of shows like Damages because they see people watching old seasons of shows. Arrested Development, same thing. So it's possible. If you love a show like The Grinder and you want Netflix to make more and it's on Netflix, you have to watch it. Even if you watched it already, watch it again. They need those numbers if they're going to make another one.
Yeah, Antonio and I have not only watched it once, we have both watched it twice.
Yeah, watched it twice, and I know I watched Scream Queens a ton, but yeah, I really enjoyed The Grinder rewatch, and I'm going to enjoy it again when I watch it again, which will inevitably happen.
Yeah, all right, Antonio, thank you so much, man, for taking so much time and being so fantastic as always.
Well, thank you, Colin, and I thank you and Dom and everyone who's guested on your show throughout the season for one of my favorite Survivor podcasts, and certainly my favorite from this perspective. I really think the perspective that you guys bring to the table is fantastic, and more talk like this. I don't want you to get discouraged because you were all in on Brad. I think the next step is like, let's look at why I went all in on Brad. Let's evaluate what that means for our calls going forward, and let's continue to adapt and evolve what we do. I think that can't wait to hear what you and Dom have to say. Can't wait to hear your podcast next season.
Well, the next step for me is going to be taking the Alex Jones route and saying it was just a character performance.
Oh, no. Are you trying to get me to use some powders right now? Like, yeah, no thanks. You can't do that, Colin. No. This is good.
No, you're totally right. It's all about not, you know, Survivor, and also, you know, playing Survivor and analyzing Survivor is all about self-reflection and improving and picking up the pieces and going from there.
Yeah, because guess what? Before this point of you being wrong, you were dead on accurate about Michelle. So you're right. Like, your thinking is correct. You are, your tea leaves are right. You had Michaela going deep. She went deep. You had Brad going deep. He went deep. Like, these are the right reads in a game like Survivor, which, by the way, I think it's possible the only reason that you were wrong in some respects is because of luck. Sarah would point out that she got very lucky. So you got to continue to make the reads you're making based on what you know about the show. And you can't just get locked into never adapting and evolving the way you look at the show. And the best way you learn is by being wrong. So I have a feeling that these takes will continue to get better and better.
Yeah, I mean, we said after the Michelle thing, hey, editors, please adapt and adjust your edit so that this isn't so easy. It was not just Michelle. It was on the heels of many consecutive people that we felt at this point, retrospectively, probably a little cocky in retrospect about how on we were about
that. Yeah, how does the humble pie taste?
No, but I'd be like, I love this season. I love that. Like, please understand, it's particularly for me, like, my life is so much more fun on Twitter when I am dead wrong about Ken or about Brad than when I'm right about Michelle.
Yeah, and it's this is the thing. I like that it's growing and evolving. Angie Kontz has a great character types podcast that she does, and she's constantly building that system because it is, quite frankly, a work in progress. And Survivor changes, and we change with it as we analyze it. And I think the real value in this is you've had a lot of players who have played the game on your podcast, but on your podcast maybe, or listening to your podcast before they play. And I think it does really inform the way people view the game and the way people play the game. So it is very much a loop. And as you talk about what Survivor could do and what they did this season, and as you and Dom have those conversations, people who will play the game in the future are listening to those conversations. It will change how the game is played, and then that will change what you're saying about the game. So it's really a fantastic cycle. I love that these podcasts are part of the Survivor universe. As a fan, I mean, no one's listening to this, especially 2 hours plus in right now, and who isn't already on board. But if you have a casual fan out there, show them how to download a podcast. Get your parents into it. Get your relatives into it. Like, show them how to do this, because I feel this way. I feel like I'm on my soapbox, but you started this podcast by saying, like, me talking to you about The Leftovers is part of what helped you get in on The Leftovers. And I know that me listening to podcasts about TV shows makes me enjoy them better. So I'm confident that that will be the experience for a lot of people. And I think that's the case with Survivor as well.
Yeah, Antonio, thank you once again. He is at AC Mazzaro on Twitter, 2Z's 1R. I'm at Colin Stone. Dom will be back soon, and we will be doing our full season in review podcast, although this one ended up very thorough stuff here, Antonio.
Sorry, Dom. Yeah, sorry.
Now we have to do 6.5 hours for our other one.
Listen, the bar's pretty high, but I have a feeling you'll jump over it. I cannot wait to hear you guys breaking it down. I'm really looking forward to that.
All right. Well, we were excited to do that. Thank you guys once again for listening. We'll be back relatively soon with all of that. Take care, everybody.
Oh, Sarah, here we go again. I can't get past the pain while I'm seeing you. I'm too old now to learn how to let you in. So I run ways like I always do. She said if there's something I should know, tell me now. Before I go and give my heart away. So I can get on with my life. You can go on with your strife. Wish you'd speak the words those I was trying to say. Sometimes it's life. There's a light, a big old dream I'm floating around on a cloud inside. When my cloud starts coming apart at the seams, oh Sarah, that's when I start.